Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe, of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. And they have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State. We're glad you're here with us. Solar Cycle 24 began January 4th with the appearance of a magnetically reversed high-latitude sunspot. After that, more than 3 months passed without another new cycle spot until this weekend. The second sunspot of Solar Cycle 24 has finally materialized. The images shown on, heavensabove.com were obtained on April 13th by the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, that's SOHO. The sunspot is a tiny-looking dark speck in the white light image. Shades of gray in the magnetogram trace the sunspot's underlying magnetic polarity, the north-south pattern signals its membership in the Solar Cycle 24. It is not a large or impressive sunspot, but it does confirm that Solar Cycle 24 has truly begun. In the months ahead, we can expect more new cycle spots as solar activity emerges from the current low ebb and surges towards the next solar maximum expected in 2011, and you guessed it, 2012. Stay tuned. The solar wind tonight is 600.9 kilometers per second, and the Earth is in the path of a giant disorganized coronal hole. This happens sometimes during solar minimums when the magnetic field of the sun relaxes slightly, allowing powerful broad proton fields to blow out into space. We're in one of those right now. Don't know if you'll see an aurora borealis, but keep your eyes open. You never know. In Colorado Springs, Reuters has an amazing story. The United States is set to start operating a powerful new military communication satellite over the Pacific next week, the first of a planned 6-satellite network that will boost data flows tenfold, the Air Force Space Command said Thursday. On its own, the maiden Boeing company-built wideband global satellite will provide more capacity for video, data, and voice than the entire group of 10 or so satellites that is designed to replace them. World oil prices rallied on Thursday after striking an all-time record above $112 per barrel. When the market was lifted by tumbling U.S. energy reserves and weakness of the dollar, traders said. New York's May oil contract, light sweet crude for delivery in May, gained 99 cents to $111.86. The contract had rocketed to a record 112.21 on Wednesday. Crude futures had soared by more than $3 on Wednesday after the U.S. Department of Energy reported that American energy stockpiles fell across the board during the week ending April 4th. Those of you that are hoping for $50 a barrel crude, keep dreaming. It's not going to happen. Scientists listening to underwater microphones have detected an unusual swarm of earthquakes off the central Oregon coast. Scientists don't know what the earthquakes mean, but they could be the result of magma rumbling underneath the Juan de Fuca Plate, away from the recognized earthquake faults off Oregon, says geologist Robert Ziak of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and Oregon State University's Hatfield Brain Science Center in Newport, Oregon. There have been more than 600 quakes over the past 10 days in a basin 150 miles west of Newport. The biggest was magnitude 5.4, and two others were more than magnitude 5, OSU reported. They have not followed the typical pattern of a major shock followed by a series of diminishing aftershocks, and few have been strong enough to be felt on shore. On the hydrophones, the quake sounds like low rumbling thunder and are unlike anything scientists have heard in 17 years of listening, Jack said. Some of the quakes have also been detected by earthquake instruments on land. The hydrophones are left over from a network the Navy used to listen to dubs the Cold War. Kind of interesting. They routinely detect passing ships, earthquakes on the ocean bottom, and whales calling to each other. Last week on X-Squared Radio, we had Tim Bauman on the program. We talked about quantum physics, reincarnation, and even the omnipresence of light. If you missed the program, you can subscribe to our archives for $20 a year. This week, we have three guests on board. Our first is our good friend Stan Dale, because we want to follow up on the Oregon earthquakes and perhaps find out what they mean, and we want to bring you breaking news on a new propulsion system that just might be the ticket for survival of the human race. Stan, how are you?
I'm good this evening, Brooks. It sounds like we got a lot of news to talk about.
Yeah, a lot of news. Interesting thing about this thing on the Oregon quakes, you know. I'm really surprised at it because normally earthquakes follow a certain pattern. We have listening stations all around the world, but this sounds different, and I just wanted to get a hold of you today and see if you had any feelings or any data that might indicate something other than an earthquake is coming our way.
Well, boy, that's hard. As you know, my access to the naval data stopped in November of 2006, and since then I've been kind of flying blind, but we in the industry of forecasting earthquakes and looking at patterns, those of us that do this do see something unusual coming toward April 20th, somewhere around in that area this year, and it would be the position of the full moon in relation to the sun and the earth at a certain time. It's a location that historically over the Cascadia area produced a large, large earthquake. It may not this time, but in in 1700, the position of the sun and the moon and the earth at that time heralded about a 9.0 earthquake, and that produced tidal waves that went inland in Oregon and in Washington and way inland, up to trees and debris way up in some of the higher places. Now, the only area on the entire Ring of Fire around the Pacific Ocean, the only area that is under severe stress and has not released in the last 50 years is the Juan de Fuca Plate, in particular the Gorda Plate portion, which is the southern portion of the Juan de Fuca. Now, before I lost the data from the naval satellite feeds and their submarines and things, I did see large thermal indicators of a large, large pressure building on what's called the Mendocino Fracture Zone. And that's about 2,000 miles long, runs out from Northern California near Eureka out west, way into the middle of the northeast Pacific Ocean. Now, the signals I was getting occurred twice, and they were just all along this 2,000-mile-long fracture zone, indicating tremendous pressures building up there. And then they backed off, and nothing happened. The problem we have with the kind of method I was using is I was using temperature changes, instantaneous temperature changes, on both sides of the fault lines, which would predict quakes. And normally when you've got heating on one side and cooling on the other side, what we call a butterfly pattern of a few hundred miles, we could say by looking at the size of that pattern, it's going to probably be a Richter 5 to 6 and within the next 10 minutes to 5 days, somewhere in that time. That was about as accurate as we could be. But when we started getting these large signals for thousands of miles, I didn't know how to forecast. I still don't, because we don't have the data. But it ties into the bottom of the Juan de Fuca Plate at the Gorda Plate. And there are three ridges in the whole Juan de Fuca Plate that we've got to be concerned with. If that releases, they're expecting a 9.0 or better earthquake. So, yes, I think we should pay attention to the flurries, especially when they're talking magma movements, because all through Cascadia and down toward California, underneath the volcanoes, we've been noticing that the magma is rising up beyond, I mean, closer than a mile beneath the surface, which is quite disturbing. So what we're telling people that are writing it.
What happens if we get a Mount St. Helens volume movement of magma and perhaps a rupture beneath the ocean out there beyond the Juan de Fuca Plate?
Well, even if it's just a few miles, 50 to 100 miles, I would be concerned because that plate is very likely to fracture and tilt. There would be very little time to even warn people on the beaches and low-lying areas that a tidal wave was coming. I mean, it's just almost ground zero for that kind of an event. Unfortunately, it's just the way it's situated. I've got a brother and his family. They live there in Tacoma, so we're very, very concerned with what's happening there.
Do you think the upcoming full moon might be a period of time of alarm?
I think so. I think so. There's been a number of studies as far back as the middle 50s done by even RCA about the positions of the planets and their moons in relation to seismic activity, particularly on the Earth. And it was done accidentally. RCA was trying to look at radio wave propagation. They found a correlation that when the moon, for instance, was at 90 degrees from where the actual bulge was going to occur on the Earth's surface, that would trigger more earthquakes than not. It's still not an exact science, but we do think that because the gravity of the moon does cause the earth and the oceans to bulge as it passes over, that if there is a quake building anyway, that movement can assist the release. And this flurry is of interest to all of us. I mean, the watches, it's unusual. And there's been a slow quake in progress there, a slow plate adjustment for the last year almost. So we could be getting ready to see some real interesting action there. I wish I had more solid details for you, Brooks, but I just can't.
Not to be an alarmist or too speculative, how big was the tsunami of the 18th century or the 19th century out there?
Oh, the 1700 one?
Right.
Actually, I can't remember how far inland what the altitude was, but looking at the map here, I know it went way up channel there just south of Vancouver. I'm just trying to picture it in my mind. It was a surge that lasted over something like 12 hours. It came and it went, came and it went. And if something like that does happen, where it does hit and rises up, you know, oh, probably 50 to 100 feet, you know, altitude, people should not be fooled when the first wave comes and goes and think, ah, that's it, because it goes out and splashes back in and comes back and forth for probably 12 to 15 hours after the main event. It gets less and less each time, but you have very little time to go move something or get to higher ground when that first wave backs out. So if it does happen, be careful about that.
How fast does the shockwave move through the water in miles per hour?
So you mean the tsunami-producing wave or what?
Yeah, right, the tsunami-producing wave. I mean, is it a slow surge like a hurricane, or is it something
no,
like
No, it's faster than that. I mean, it's kind of like how long is a piece of string. If the plate that produces it is at a certain angle, you could see it travel at several hundred miles an hour up to almost near the speed of sound, you know, 600 to 650 miles an hour. But it will start to slow as it comes inland because it's going to start hitting the shelf. And depending upon the shelf's geometry, you know, it's got chunks of rock here and there, it'll break the wave and slow it down a bit and start it to curling. But it's not something for you to stand there and say, oh, look, there comes a tsunami. I think I'll just get in my car and drive up the hill. It's like,
I think
the tsunami coming, you run.
It's too late. By the way,
you can't outrun them unless you're in a car or something like that, so...
Right, and you better be in the car with it running because you only have 8 miles of view from the beach. If you're standing on the beach, you can only see 8 miles out, and at 200 miles an hour, you can cross 8 miles in about 3 minutes.
Yes.
That's 600 miles an hour. It's substantially less.
Yeah.
10 miles a minute.
It's spooky, isn't it?
Yep, that's not much time. So if you don't have access to the Navy data, are there other sources from which you can draw?
Well, there are, but they're not accurate enough. You see, the Navy had a satellite configuration, probably Milstar that they used, plus buoys all over the planet, plus data from their submarines and surface craft. And they put all that into this one super-duper high-resolution thermal anomaly map. And they didn't realize what they had. They were just looking at sea surface temperatures and the changes of them, what they call the anomaly. And I accidentally discovered the anomaly was a precursor to major earthquakes by studying it over a number of years. And for probably 9 to 10 years, I was able to do that, and it got more and more accurate. In fact, Holly and I went out to the Navy Center at the FENMOC Center at Monterey, California, and they very kindly took us into the classified area there, close to the Cray computer they use, and we met with the programmer in charge of the data I was using. And they were amazed to see what I had done and said, look, you know, we can't officially endorse it, but we know that we have some errors in our data from cloud cover. It introduces maybe a 30% error in what we're doing over certain areas of the ocean at certain times. And I said, well, even with that, I said, I'm still getting between 60 and 70% accuracy with my quakes. And they said, well, we won't endorse it. You know, we can't, but we'll be visiting your site every day. Well, anyway, it was that accurate. And then they changed over to a new satellite system and new programming and a new computer. And in the process, according to the official explanation, they dropped the project that was collecting the data for the thermal imaging maps that I was using. Now, up until that time, there had been 50 little small island nation states representative of them that were using the data to warn them of tsunami potentials, you know, that I was producing. And there was also the Mexican Admiralty. They rang me and organized a conference call with all the leading admirals of the Mexican Navy to see how to read these maps because they had seen that it was accurate enough. And they wanted to know so they could predict, you know, tsunamis on the Mexican's west coast. So we were getting support, and so much so that the public reaction every time I posted something like look out or whatever, there was a hue and cry raised. And I suppose that's probably motivation for let's don't stir up the people, let's take this information source away, and so they did.
Oh, so you were changing the price of real estate with your website.
Well, actually, I wondered about that. You know, anybody that's asked me, can I live here or there? I'd say, well, definitely do not live on the coast of the United States anywhere. Move inland and to higher ground, because all the coastal areas, in, right up the Mississippi even, are dangerous areas. And
that's
so I'm sure the real estate brokers hated me, but that's the way it is.
Buy your beachfront property in Arizona.
The Hopi, when we were visiting them, they took me out to the edge of the second mesa, the Shungopapi people did, and let me look over the edge down into the barren desert floor, and they said, you know, we are beginning to end the fourth age of man and enter the fifth age soon, and when we do, the water will be beneath us here up to a level that we can go between the mesas here by canoe and boat. And that's 5,000 feet above sea level where we were standing.
That's pretty deep.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's so deep or whether it's portions of the crust will sink in that area and get, you know, it may be a combination of both of them.
Oh,
but
yeah, I got you.
I wondered, you know, how can it rise a mile? We can't do that. But if the land goes down, subsiding from, you know, coastal dropping off and fracturing along the Cascadia, then I can see how it might reach them.
Well, I know you can only stay a few more minutes with us, but I did want to ask you about your propulsion technology. We had talked a little bit about that by email off the air, and wondered if you were prepared to give us any information on it.
Well, I did mention on air probably probably 3 or 4 months back on coast that we were going to do this year. And what we're doing is releasing information on new kinds of propulsion in stages. The first stages that I'll release to the public will be air and water propulsion systems, which will use off-the-shelf components, except for hull designs and mainframe or airframe designs, off-the-shelf components so that you can build your own aircraft or submarine or surface craft that will use a lot less fuel, go faster, and leave no wake behind you, and will allow you to break the sound barrier if you have enough grunt in your engines. We're not going to introduce, at this point, anti-gravity, because I feel it would be irresponsible to even give, you know, publicly the formulas or basic circuit for same, because even though I'm pretty sure we're on the right track of what we're doing, we know what we're doing, and we take precautions to keep from vaporizing ourselves and several houses around us. It is not an amateur's game, and certainly not something we want to pass on to terrorists or potential terrorists. So that part we're holding back until things cool down, you know, settle down on the planet. But the aircraft, it looks like a flying saucer. It is a flying saucer. It utilizes a form of propulsion that is called entrainment or negative drag propulsion. It will allow you to travel probably three times as far as you could on a normal tank of gas in an ultralight. We're hoping to make one or two-man versions of it after we finish testing the remote control smaller models. We do have one of those probably 6 weeks away from going from launching. We've been having to rearrange some of the geometry on it for our GPS sensors and thermal and power sensors and torque converters and digital gyroscopes and all the other things that we need to make it work and send data back to us. But we're quite happy that we filed the provisional patents on it earlier this year, and I hope that we will be able to teach people a whole lot about this new method of propulsion so they can adapt it to their own methods, whether it be you know, bicycles or cars or airplanes or what.
Now, do you have an OEM version? Do you have a manufacturing source in mind to mass produce the technology, or are you just going to release drawings?
No, that's a good question, Brooks, because one of the problems that we're having, we've set up a new company to do this called Halo Orbital Technologies, and the problem we're seeing in our long-range business plan is this. If we sell these things one or two or five or ten at a time, when the first model gets into the public and is picked up by Chinese intelligence, industrial, you know, espionage or whatever, they will have a better, cheaper version landed on our western coast within 2 weeks. That means we can't get our investors' money back in time, you know, to make a profit because the Chinese will clobber us and they don't honor our patent treaties.
Right.
So we've been looking at ways to get around that, and one way is for me to do a large media presence saying, look, we are going to make these available. Here's what it looks like. You know, some photographs that, that show basically how it all works without showing the inside of it. And say, if you want it, it'll cost you this much for this kind, this much for that kind. We'll take your orders now. We'll get enough advance orders that we can then make what we need, distribute to those people on a certain day, and then if the Chinese come and steal it from us, well, at least we've made our investors a profit and we've gotten the technology out there. But they make it very hard for us to do anything without them just shutting us down overnight.
Well, I understand the value of intellectual property and the fact that there are third world countries that have no more respect for our patents than do anyone that, that has no integrity in business. But if you go into mass production and you get the cost down due to scalable tooling and you launch them like, say, the Segway was launched, that was certainly revolutionary technology, you can sell enough units fast enough to capitalize and create some market momentum, and then rely on the U.S. government to keep imports from coming back in without huge tariffs in order to protect the technology.
Oh, I know. I saw that that legislation that said it was going to protect us, but it just doesn't work. The little devils, they get around it one way or another.
Yeah.
But I agree with you, Brooks. Mass production, front end, you know, putting them in a warehouse and suddenly releasing it all, is probably going to be the only way that we can hope to stay in business and get the momentum up. We're
right.
Looking at other things way, you know, way after the aircraft, but I'm still debating how we will announce this to the media, because it is going to be an extraordinary craft. I'm very happy with what I'm seeing here on the computer simulations, and we're excited about all the bits and pieces and fitting them together and being able to educate people about this new kind of propulsion. It's taken me 35 years to understand the ins and outs of it to the degree I have, and I'm behind what is in the black ops anyway. And we may even have these things, you know, I know we have the anti-gravity technology, or we did when I was in with Keller's program. So what I'm doing is a civilian, non-classified adaptation of that, and I don't think we're going to get any, you know, hassles for doing that. But I think we need this when things start to fall apart from natural disasters or from invasion or from whatever in the United States, Civil War, where the roads will not be safe to travel. It'll be like in the old days, there'll be bandits or highwaymen, you know, gangs to try to rip off whatever you got in your car and your truck or whatever. So the only way I could figure to get around that was to go airborne with a cheap propulsion system, and this saucer is what we're looking at. So hopefully we'll get it ready in time.
A la Mad Max, so I know exactly where you're coming from.
Oh,
one of my favorite
absolutely. You remember Mad Max? They did have one of those. They did have that Mad Max. Did he some kind of a flying gizmo?
Yeah, that's how they got around.
Yeah.
But I have one suggestion for maybe a release, and that's to let me come watch the prototype launch, and you know, we'll use our multimedia abilities and try to get it out there beyond where normal media can censor it.
Well, I don't think they'll censor it, but you know, the big problem really is going to be, as you pointed out, getting your manufacturing done quietly here. The two engineers that we've brought on board to help us with RC engineers have both just absolutely dropped their upper teeth when they saw what they were looking at, and once the secret's out, it'll be easy to duplicate this particular version, the air version, and then the water version eventually. So we're having to be very careful who we bring in to work on it, because at this point we can't trust the patent office even. We've got to be showing due diligence and keeping it secret as a corporate secret rather than relying on the patent.
Yep, that's exactly what we did too. Just trade secret it, and that way you can control all the methods of outlet and nothing becomes public domain.
Yeah, like, so if I tell you, I'd have to shoot you, Brooks.
that's right. Well, you know, we've kind of come across the same thing in launching this biodiesel plant up here in eastern Washington State. You know,
I was wondering about that. You said you were going into ethanol eventually, but you're in methanol now, or what?
Yeah, we're in methanol now. It doesn't really give us complete energy independence because the methanol is imported from Venezuela, but ethanol would surely work. We just don't want to use it if it's made from food. We're trying to get cellulosic ethanol launched in a big way. There's our company was instrumental in getting the recent legislation passed. As you know, the first energy bill in 50 years got passed, and in it was $1.2 billion for cellulosic ethanol, which is great because it takes all the trash, you know, the corn cobs and stalks and straw and all that stuff, and turns it into ethanol, which can be used
for fuel.
They break
down the cellulose, do they?
Yeah, and of course our algae technology provides sugar for the ethanol as well and eats up the CO2 from the process, so it's very symbiotic.
Yeah, wasn't the University of North Carolina, is it? One of the universities over on the eastern coast has been doing a lot of work in that pond scum stuff to, you know, the algae to especially bred to do this.
Yeah,
to eat
yep.
stuff and convert it for us.
Fortunately, the U.S. government did about 80% of the work for us and then defunded the program in 1996 under Clinton, and we just bought it lock, stock, and barrel and went through all the breeds, and we found two breeds. One was a very nice fat algae, but it divided very slowly, and another one that was very prolific and had very little body fat, and we bred the two together and came up with our own proprietary breed that divides every 4 hours and has 20% body fat right in the right lipid weight for biodiesel, and it works out really,
really
nice.
So are you going to produce this for other biodiesel manufacturers or just to hold it under your license?
Well, yes, we are definitely going to do that. We're getting ready to build one in Missouri for another biodiesel plant, and we're getting ready to build one in Southern California for another biodiesel plant. And then we have this biodiesel plant here in Eastern Washington State. But the reactor that we have is the proprietary part. Instead of taking 8 hours to make biodiesel, it takes just a few seconds. So it's a continuous manufacturing process, unlike the batch process that that fills the industry right now with waste. And
so you do small amounts, but fast.
Yes, and no emissions. So we capture all the emissions and recycle everything.
So how many million gallons a year do you think your thing there will do when it gets operational?
This plant will do 8 million gallons at startup, and then in about a year we'll add one more ion tower to it and bring it up to 16 million gallons a year. But it's capable of doing 32 million when it's completely scaled out.
You know, it's almost like we waited too long to start doing all this, because to feed all the hungry cars and stuff, we need so many million barrels a day.
Oh, I know. But you know what's encouraging, though, Stan, is the last 5 years, the federal government has made this 99-cent blending credit available, which gives blenders a little more buying power. And
right,
we've actually crossed the 240 million gallon a year mark in less than 5 years. So I'm thinking in the next 3 years we're going to cross the 2 billion gallon a year mark, and that's going to be significant. That's going to create some refinery capacity for our oil companies, and they're going to be able to do more chemical work instead of just hogging everything out the diesel fuel. And it's going to be good. I'm thinking in 5, maybe 6 years, we'll cross that 2 billion, maybe 3 billion gallons a year. And then the price of diesel will come down and get fixed, and before too long we'll be energy independent because we'll be growing our fuel instead of drilling for it.
And the other thing, too, is that we need to switch over to other forms of producing our domestic and corporate electricity, you know, the power
oh,
for that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's one of our conglomerate partners is MWK Biogas, and they have 330
yeah.
plants in Europe where they turn, you know, cow manure into electricity and
right.
very high-grade fertilizer, but zero plants in the U.S., none. We just have a real hard time getting communities in this country interested in free electricity. I don't know
Not
why.
Not only that, even with the petroleum-based electricity stuff, we've got plenty of oil. But no refineries to do it. Since the 1970s, we haven't been replacing infrastructure, just letting it go to pieces and drop off the edge. I mean, it falls through the cracks, and we're having to depend on other countries to refine this stuff. I think that's probably why they've authorized another 40 nuclear reactors here in the United States, or 40 plus.
Well, they just shut one down in Europe because the biogas industry has now generated enough electricity that they were able to shut down one nuclear reactor.
Well, with all the McDonald's burgers floating around, surely to shit, we should be able to use the cow manure and organize it into a replacement for these nuclear plants. I mean, it's madness to keep piling up nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain or whatever, which is going to overflow in 10 years probably. We're just creating a bigger problem for ourselves by going that way. We've got to go toward the cow manure.
I'm with you 100%, and that's why I work in this industry, and I don't even work. I enjoy what I do so much. I'm at the plant today, and I'm just enjoying the heck out of it.
Are you really?
Yep, I'm actually doing my show from my office at the plant, so it's working out really nicely.
Well, we'll have to talk off air here one of these days and kick some ideas around about technology, because
definitely. And then we, of course, you know, our friends down at the Phoenix Science Foundation have that factory in Eastern Kentucky with open factory floor space just waiting to
mass
production. 70,000 square feet.
Oh, wow. Well, we're going to have to come up with some clever solutions when we start making the bigger ones, how to make these saucer-shaped things in sections and tie them together. I don't think we're going
to
be able to turn it. Say again?
I said, sounds good to me. Before I dabbled in this hobby of talking on the radio for the last 30 years, that's all I've done is manufacturing engineering, building factories.
Really? Oh, we definitely will have to talk.
Okay, Stan, we will. I appreciate you coming on the program. You've been with us for a half an hour, and we agreed not to encroach on your private time too much, so...
Well, I hope that's been some help, Brooks.
Oh, absolutely, Stan, absolutely. And we appreciate you coming on, and we'll definitely be back in touch.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Stan. Good night.
Good night.
All right, Earth Explorers, we'll take a very short break, a couple of minutes, and we'll get our next guest on here. Sally is a dreamwalker, and you're going to enjoy the rest of this. So hang in there. We'll play a little bit of music. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Ian, and I want to invite you to visit Ian's Place every Sunday at 4 p.m. At Ian's Place, we have the most powerful conversations on talk radio. If you want to start living your life your way, then Ian's Place is the place for you. We're going to cut to the chase and have...
Hello, this is Mariko May. I'm really happy you're enjoying the rich variety of music on bbsradio.com. Please give me a visit at www.marcome.com. Hope to see you.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Your host, Brooks Agnew, believes everything we do will eventually affect the universe. He's trying to do that on purpose each Sunday from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the BBS Radio Network. Come where the results are always positive. Explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You'll be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch. X Squared Radio.
And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State. Our previous guest in our first half hour was Stan Deo. We talked about the swarm of earthquakes off the coast of Oregon and his new propulsion technology. This is a three-hour program, and if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to let us know at x2-radio.com. And we'll take care of the rest. We are a member of the BBS Radio Network and also the Steeleye Media Network. And we're glad you're here with us tonight. We're going to open the phone lines for the rest of the night. Toll free, U.S. 888-228-4494. Toll free anywhere in Canada, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And those of you that are using Skype, simply put in BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBS Radio _com. We trying to accommodate. Our next guest is a person with some amazing talents. She is a dream walker. Her name is Sally, and we want to give her a warm welcome. Hi, Sally. How are you?
I'm fine, Brooke. How are you?
I know you're a little nervous. Pay no attention.
To the man behind the curtain?
Yes. No one's listening to us. It's just you and me talking on the Internet. And there might be 48,000 people listening, but we're not going to pay any attention to them right now. I'm fascinated by the subject matter because there are some strange things becoming apparent to the world right now. There are more people living on Earth now than have ever lived here.
Uh-huh.
And if we are to believe in reincarnation, then where are the souls coming from?
Well, you have to realize that the soul that you believe you are is only a small portion of who you really are. So each soul, if you want to call it that, is actually living multiple lives in multiple dimensions. And as you know, there's no such thing as time in those other dimensions. So you can be living a multitude of lives all at the same time. The neat thing is when you can tap into those other lives and bring those skills or talents or abilities into this one. Now, you're only consciously aware of this one, because that's where your ego is right now, this small portion of you. But there's so much more to you. You have no idea.
Well, you don't know if I have an idea or not. That's what we're going to find out.
Okay, all right.
That's
most people don't.
You know, yeah, you're right. Most people don't. You know, I think that there are spirits from other worlds coming here.
Absolutely.
So, you know, how do you think they come here?
The same way we do.
So
how to explain it simply? We're all one. There is only one of us.
Oh.
There is only one. That one breaks off little pieces to explore this reality or that reality or whatever. But we're all the same being. We're all the same energy. We just don't have a conscious awareness of our connection until we develop it, and humanity is definitely expanding and developing that connection. I think, honestly, that's what we tried to do when we created religions. We felt so isolated, but somehow deep inside we knew we were part of something bigger, so we named it God, and we created a religion around it. Unfortunately, usually something that is created by man gets perverted, and it gets a little bit skewed and a little bit, and then people forget what the original motivation was, and they just carry this institution on and make their own rules for it and so on, and by that time they've lost sight completely of what the original intention was. But we're coming back to that now. That's my belief.
Well, I think it's interesting that religion, as far back as you can find writings or hieroglyphs or whatever, seems to separate man from deity. In fact, I don't really find too many, except maybe Tibetan Buddhism, that unifies the human on Earth with the God out there somewhere or in there somewhere.
Right.
It is essentially Christian religions that has separated God from man and said God is God and man is man and ne'er the two shall meet.
Now, why would they do that?
Well, I can see it's the same thing that governments do. They hoard the knowledge and hoard the access to things like capital and technology. And then they tell the people, in order to get to capital and get to knowledge, you have to go through us. Because
yeah.
We are the authorized
we're the guardians of the gateway. You can't get there without us, and you have to pay us to do it.
There you go.
One way or the other. That's it. And they don't want people to know that they are God themselves. Each one of us is a piece of God. And we don't need an intermediary of any sort. But that gets to the question of, we don't want to take responsibility for ourselves. We want someone else to be responsible, so we have someone else to blame.
Well, I think that's also a role that religion has played, sort of a self-perpetuating sugar daddy that, you know, tells people you're guilty, you're a sinner, you're filthy rags before God. So come to us, and we'll make sure that you get fixed with the man upstairs. But don't do it again. And if you do, we're going to have to start all this all over again. So it's a self-perpetuating system of guilt and punishment.
Which perpetuates the institution. That's called retirement plan.
Yeah, so when the being, when the human becomes aware, well, let's just say they awaken and they start tapping into their other presences, their other inputs that are not living in a world full of war or poverty or disease or pain or want or poverty. How does that show up in the person that's here, seemingly completely immersed in the 3D world?
Well, quite often it emerges and they're diagnosed as being bipolar or schizophrenic or whatever, and they're institutionalized in the past. Now, I mean, have you heard the statistics on the people who are diagnosed as being bipolar these days? It's just an epidemic. Because more and more people are waking up, but medicine isn't ready yet to say, hey, maybe this is something natural and we need to look a little closer.
Yeah, I'm beginning to think I need to go back and do this all over again, because I'm sure I'm bipolar. I must be.
Well, so am I. It's just being a greater human. It means you're aware of more. It means you feel more, you sense more, you use more than just your five senses and your intellect.
Yeah.
You know things that you can't prove, and you have no way of telling anybody how you know it, but you do.
So does that mean I'm eligible for 40 years of back disability pay?
Ah, good luck. If it works, let me know, because I could sign up. I don't think so. Unfortunately, they don't want to support people to expand themselves. They really would like us to stay in our little boxes and don't question their authority and don't make waves. But the waves are being made. The planet is making a lot of waves lately. Well, that's a manifestation of our consciousness, humanity's consciousness. And we're reflecting what's happening to the planet, and the planet is reflecting what we are experiencing. So we're all one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we could talk about that a little bit more, too. Now,
sure.
You wrote an article, and in your article you mention three things. You mentioned Xers, indigos, and crystals. So let's start with the Xers. What are these?
Well, it's an expression they're using now, the Generation X. And I'm not sure exactly what it is. I know they've got a delineation of if you were born between this year and that year, you're a Gen X. This year and that year is a Gen Y. And now I think there's a Gen Z even out there. It's just different stages of development. Indigo is another stage of development.
We'll talk about that in a second. But
okay.
The Xers are, we had the greatest generation, and then we had the boomers, and
mm-hmm.
Now we have the children of the boomers, and they're the Generation X, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
and
they don't really have a legacy. We just haven't
fought
wars.
No. Each generation, each group has set the foundation. They have done the exploration to as far as they were able to go within the 3D society, because like some of the things, the dream walking, for example, or the psychic diagnosis that I've done, when I learned it in 1979, had I decided to go out and make myself public and try to do it professionally, I probably would have been locked up. This was not something mainstream society was in any way ready for. And so that was not my choice. It was something I did on the quiet and just assisted people when and where I could. But because I was not the only one, there were other people learning these skills and expanding them, and some did go public. Carolyn Mist is one, Miss or Mace, I never remember how to pronounce her name. Several other people have gone public, have built careers on it, so it has become more known to the general public. But there were lots of people behind the scenes doing the same things. The thing is, you know the story of the 100th monkey?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. It's the same thing. You have your pathfinders who come in. Nobody knows what they know. They're the trailblazers. They plant the seed. They start the whole progression. Gradually, people pick up on it, and it's a very, to my mind, it was an extremely slow process. But finally, more people know about it, and more people, and then it starts to break into the mainstream. Of course, it's called woo-woo and way out there and these fruitcakes. But eventually, enough people not only know about it, but have experienced it, that it then becomes not quite so strange. I can't do it, but I do believe that some people can, and that's when we all started going to psychics. We didn't think we could do that, but we would trust what a psychic said to us because they were just so accurate. And now more and more people are finding, you know, I can do the same thing. I don't need to go to anybody else. It's a matter of focusing, believing what is possible, and practice.
Right. Well, now, what about the indigos? What are they?
Indigos are the next group of kids that came in, and they've had kind of a rough time. That I consider myself a very early indigo. And they're the ones that really knew from birth that there was something far more than they could see or perceive or learn about, but they didn't know what it was or where it was. They were often absolutely appalled at what they saw on Earth. The cruelty and the stupidity and the way people treated each other for no good reason that was apparent to them. It's a very difficult stage to have gone through.
Including
because,
their parents.
And a lot of them committed suicide because they just couldn't deal with it. They weren't in touch enough with their higher self to know why they were there. All they knew was something was very wrong. Go ahead.
I was going to say, these aren't all the kids that are coming in now, right? Just some of them are indigos and some are not?
Kids that are coming in now are crystal.
Well,
crystals are real
hard. We'll talk about them in a second. But say 15, 18 years ago, the kids that were coming in, many of them had remarkable abilities to memorize, to imagine, to artistically create, to program. They were almost like savants, except, you know, they were halfway, you know, socially adept. But most of the kids that I see today are somewhat, you know, socially retarded. They don't interact well with others.
They're absolute systems busters. They do not accept the rules just because they're the rules. And it is difficult for the rest of us to deal with them, even me. Sometimes I think, you know, could you just tone it down? You're bouncing off the walls here. But that is their energy. It is so clear and so bright, and they cannot understand how we limit ourselves, why we limit ourselves. And they don't yet have the maturity or the patience to slow down and put themselves in someone else's shoes and say, oh, okay, I see you're this many years old and you've had this many years of programming and you're working through that, but you see, they come in without the training that we had, and their parents couldn't train them to do that. They just refused. Absolutely refused.
Yeah.
These are the troubled kids right now.
It sounds like this generation, or at least the ones that are coming of age right now, are the ones that have what it takes to save us all or waste the world away like spoiled brats. I don't know which one it is, but some of the kids are bright and, in fact, act like geniuses, and others
Incredibly.
Are just corn-chip cowboys who think the world owes them a living. So
Absolutely.
how do we find the diamonds among the coal?
We're all diamonds. The difficulty is finding what is their particular way to shine, and you can't do it by the old methods that we've used. I mean, you can't bully them into it. You can't beat them into it. They'll just say, I'm out of here, and they're gone.
Well, I have to tell you, mm-hmm. you know, before I got married, I had four theories on how to raise kids, and then I had four kids, and now I have no theories. So
you're not alone.
There's no book on it. There's no way to know. You know, every kid is different, has his own abilities, has his own imaginations and fears, and I tried to teach my kids not to have fear, and never, but never accept no for an answer. Always try to make your case.
And they made you regret those words sometimes, didn't they?
No, I don't, but I'm sure their teachers have. And
yes.
They've complained to me, hey, you know, I tell your kid he can't do this, and then he comes back to me and says, why? And and he starts making his case, and darn if he doesn't convince me to change my mind.
Exactly.
Why did you do that? And I said, because that's the real world. I don't want my kids to accept no for an answer. Even if I say no, they come back to me and say, why not? I've got this case I'm going to make. And sometimes they win and sometimes they don't. But I do let them win. And I am proud to say I have never said in my whole life, because I said so.
Good for you.
I never use that kind of authority.
Good for you. Because it's baseless. It has no meaning to them. If you can give them a good reason why or why not, usually they'll go along with it. That's not without necessarily stomping their feet or being all shoot, but they will understand the logic behind it.
Yeah.
But if you tell them just because I say so or because those are the rules, forget it. They're here to bust the systems, and believe me, they're going to do it.
Yeah.
So you can either learn to get along with them and learn to get the best out of them that they can give, or you can end up having high blood pressure or a heart attack or whatever because you're so stressed out, because the kids won't be. They don't hold on to any emotion.
Well,
they let it flow through, which is what we all need to learn.
I can't say I'm a product of that, but I'm a survivor of it, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you mentioned a third type of being, and that's a crystal. So now what is a crystal?
Crystal are, they're children that are being born now and in the past few years, very few years, that are coming in with this clarity. They're more the genius ones that you're talking about. They have abilities that are absolutely astounding sometimes. They can look at you. You may have experienced this. You'll find a child. You can be in a restaurant. This happened to me. I was in a restaurant, and this child was just so beautiful. And it wasn't just the physical beauty. There was absolute light shining out of her eyes. And she looked at me, and it was like she knew who I was. She knew everything about me. She knew all my secrets, all my dirty stuff, everything. And it didn't matter, and she just beamed love at me. These kids are, honestly, they're angels on earth. They're not always physically beautiful, but there is a beauty in their soul and in their eyes that everyone recognizes.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now you're
been visited by an angel.
I know you're saying the last 2 or 3 years that they've been born, but
no longer than that. I may be cutting that too short, because some of them are 8 or 9, 10 now.
That there's some in their early teens because I've run into them out here on remote, you know, as I do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm literally from Earth. I just don't have any roots right now and don't really care. But, I'm meeting some amazing young people, just incredibly bright and incredibly positive. And I really think that once, you know, they're old enough to have things turned over to them, everything's going to be okay.
Yep. And remember, when I say indigo or crystal or whatever, it's not a firm and hard fast. If you were born on September 14th, 19 whatever, you are this. And if you were born 1 minute after midnight on the next day, you're something else. There's always going to be the forerunners and the few that come in early, but they're coming in bulk now. They're coming in large numbers now.
They're not from
here,
are
they? There's a lot of psychic kids.
They're not from here, are they?
No more than any of us are.
Well,
many of them, you're right, many of them, this is their first lifetime on Earth.
Okay, because I do know people who have been recycled many times on this planet, and they're just now beginning to get it.
Yeah.
Others, I'm sure, have no prior experience on this world at all. They're still trying to get their legs.
Now, are you talking young people or old people?
Well, you know, young people are relative, let's say.
Okay.
I've met some 50-year-olds that, although in a soul lifetime they're immensely ancient, they are so young at heart and so amazingly still amazed at the world, at the morning, and
uh-huh.
they're a joy to be around.
But that's not that they that this is their first lifetime on Earth. That's their connection with Source. That's what happens when you're connected with Source. You are joyful. You are everything is new. Everything puts you in awe. You recognize everything as a miracle. And you're fully present in the now. There is no other time. There is no before or after. There is just now. And they are totally present. And that is a wonderful energy to be around. I get there once in a while, but I'm not there all the time myself.
I do meet the now people, and I have empathy with that. But they also have very, very evident awareness
mm-hmm.
of past experience
mm-hmm.
and past success and past
mm-hmm.
social structure that isn't from here.
Okay. Well, as I say, we all come from someplace else, and everyone has had lifetimes on other planets, in other galaxies.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at. And that kind of leads us to this next thing, because, you know, in Japan, when I was working there, I ran across two major religious groups, not counting the Christians. We'll just talk about the others, between
mm-hmm.
Buddhism and Shinto. Now,
mm-hmm.
Shinto is kind of the young people's religion, because it's more here and now, and Buddhism is more with the eternities and recycling life and becoming, you know, reaching nirvana. And when people are young, they don't really care about or think about death and recycling all that. They're more interested in what can I do now and how can I be successful and what am I going to do with my family and my life. And then as they get older, those priorities change and they switch more over to the Buddhism. So you see an age stratification. But in our society, we're not too familiar with the concept of death. We are afraid of it as a people.
Absolutely.
So,
well, we don't respect our elderly either.
Yeah. But,
so,
you know, even young people, when they get ill and it looks like they're going to be terminal, they are full of fear. And
mm-hmm.
there is a special being that you talk about and you try to describe, and that is a dreamwalker. So...
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what a dreamwalker does.
Okay, a dreamwalker is someone who walks with the dead from the moment of death sometimes, or sometimes after they've already passed, through the realms afterlife, and there are many levels. They progress through those levels, and then they will get to what our group calls the Bridge of Flowers. Other disciplines have different names for it, but it's the same thing. It's basically the bridge to the One, heaven, whatever you want to call it, where you rejoin everything, everyone, that is in spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The dreamwalker is a person who is in the body, who sends their spirit along with the departed person. Now, okay. Sends their consciousness along with the person, but in the beginning they are there as an observer. They're not there to influence them. They're not there to tell them where to go or what to do. They're simply there to be company. But quite often, the person who has departed cannot see them. Because what happens when you die is you will create whatever you believe is going to happen to you after you die. So if you believe in a heaven, and you believe you deserve to go there, and I'm talking your deepest core believes it, not your conscious ego self, then you will create a heaven in the guise of whatever you imagine it to be, and you can stay there as long as you like. Conversely, if you believe in hell and that you deserve to go to hell, you will create that. Flames, eternal torment, whatever. At that point, all the dreamwalker can do is be there and observe. Until the individual gets to a point in their processing that they think, wait a minute, there's got to be more to it than this. Or even asks the question, isn't there more than this? I mean, heaven's wonderful, but after a few centuries of it, by their time sense, not ours, you know, it can get kind of tedious, and they can think, there's got to be more to it than this. I'm tired of sitting on a cloud storming my heart, you know, there's got to be more to it. at that point, they can then see the dreamwalker. And the dreamwalker can ask them, are you ready to move on? And then if they say, yes, I am, I don't know where I'm going, but yes, I'm ready for a change, then the dreamwalker can walk with them. And they will have to go through various events in their lives that is considered unfinished business by the soul itself. The dreamwalker has no judgment in this. But they will go through several experiences where they can observe and feel the emotions of everyone involved in those events. And they can come to some clarity about, why did I choose that to happen? What did I benefit from? How did I benefit from it? How did I impact other people? And so on. And once they've come to a point
of... It sounds like it could either be a burden or a joy. Sally, we're not quite done talking about this. Can you hang with us for another 10 or 15 minutes after the break?
No problem. No problem.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back after these commercials. But hang with us, because Sally's going to tell us a little bit more about Dreamwalkers. We'll be back with Hour 2 of X Squared Radio after this. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Consciousness. life is vital to space travel.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Sagnu, and we're glad you're here. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State. And it's actually quite nice today. Our Aki window forecast says sunshine. Want to let you know the Arc of Millions of Years, Volume 3, which is called Unlocking the Secret, will be off the presses in about 2.5 weeks. So we'll make that available for you. We're going to have a special running. We'll probably put all three volumes together into one set so that it, even if you've bought one book, you can have access to all three at a great deal. And that way, if you buy the book again, we'll send you the audio book and we'll make it worth your while, and you'll help us climb the charts and maybe get a little bit more information out there for the general public. Again, Unlocking the Secret, coming off the presses in about 2.5 weeks. I want to make sure you know the phone lines are open. Toll-free U.S. 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on the planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And if you're reaching us with Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. We are part of the BBS Radio Network and also the Steve Lai Media Network through our friend Kevin Smith. And we appreciate both networks very much for carrying X Squared Radio. Also, we don't really have an update on the expedition this week. We have added a couple of possibilities to the science staff. But no real progress on the funding side, so we are working with it. Hopefully we have this put together and funding in place, and we will be taking what many are calling the greatest expedition in history in the summer of 2009. Maybe this time we won't give it such publicity that we sell out the charters 2 months early and thus preclude ourselves from taking the expedition with the mighty nuclear-powered Yamal, which is the only boat on the planet that can make this trip. My guest right now is Sally. She is a dreamwalker, and she's been telling us about indigos and crystals and such. And there are a couple of concepts I want to go into with her. One is, Sally, you know, there are a lot of people living here on the Earth right now, more people than have ever lived here before. And we're not getting along all that well. And maybe because we've set up our energy systems the way we have, or our sociology the way we have, we're all grouped together in mega cities. And I fly over this country and your country on a regular basis, and I see a lot of open space down there where people could live in peace if they could just get away from each other and you know, have a little society instead of a big sea of people, you know, trying to make their identity with every sort of radical mutilation they can think of. So my question is, why are these very aware, very bright, very genius beings coming here at this time? Why do you think?
Because humanity is evolving. And I know, looking at our situation at the moment, it doesn't seem like we're getting better, but in fact we are. If you have a condition in the body that's causing illness, it has to be lanced, it has to be surgically removed or chemically treated, whatever method we choose, and it's the same with humanity. There are issues we've had all along that we've tried various ways to deal with, mostly ignoring who we are. That has been the biggest thing to get people to understand. And I think Marianne Williamson had a great statement that I know has been attributed to Nelson, is it Mandela? Our deepest fear is not that we're inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. This is only a part of the quote, but I think this is the truth. We know deep inside that we are very special, each one of us. When the ego gets involved, we begin to think, I am very special, but you're not. You're not as special as I am. So we've been working through, and I think these high beings are coming in because they are able to see, without the programming, they're able to see that spark of the divine in each person that they meet. And just meeting someone like that, if you've ever met the Dalai Lama, or as you've mentioned, other people you've met that are just so joyful and so in awe of everything, you can't be the same person after meeting someone like that.
Yeah,
they have
exactly.
an effect on you. Yeah, they have an effect on you. And that's why they're here. They don't have to do anything. They just have to be. And their energy will spread through everyone they meet. And
now,
it won't be overnight.
That is a concept. That's a concept that's difficult for people in 3D to understand. We have, you know, three aspects of existence. We have being and doing and having. And unfortunately, or I don't know if it's the capitalist society we live in or what it is, but so many people are concentrating on the having.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not thinking about the being, and they're empty. I walk by them on the sidewalk. Their eyes are empty. There's no
yes.
vibration coming off these people at all.
Right. Which is why they want to have. They're trying to fill that hole that they feel in themselves with stuff. And it never works. So they just get more stuff and more stuff rather than saying, wait a minute, this isn't working. What am I missing? The truth is, you have everything that you can possibly ever have, and so does everyone else. The problem is, we will only allow a certain amount of it into our lives, which is tied into what we feel we deserve, which is tied into, but if I have it, I might be taking it from someone else, so I can't do that. We've been sold such a bill of goods by capitalism that we can change our emotional state. We will feel better if we own more, if we have this little box or that little toy or this car, special car, whatever. We equate ourselves with our possessions. Nothing could be further from the truth, but that's what many of us have been raised to believe.
Well,
and
for the most part, you know, we are a society of collectors. We want to have, you know, one of 24. We want to have a piece of jewelry no one else has. We want to have a style of clothing that's not too different, but just different enough that no one else is wearing it to the same event we're going to. We
mm-hmm.
want to have a house on the hill that overlooks everyone else. There's something about our mores, and I don't know if it's this way in every country, but I think so, because I've traveled around and I've seen it. There is this desire, like you said, this ego that drives people to want to be better than everyone
mm-hmm.
else.
When yeah.
really what they should be driving for is being better than themselves.
Yes. Yes. And better in a different criteria than how much stuff you own. Using a different criteria than that. And that
yeah.
has been the problem, and that is our capitalist society, and we're not the only country like that. And then there are the poor who have nothing, and everyone has pity, except many times I've found the poor, I'm not talking about the absolutely starving people, but the basically very poor people who live from day to day, they still can have a joy in life, a joy in their family, in their relationships. There is love in the family that many of these rich people who have all these toys don't have.
Well, that's true. I remember the story of the kids coming out with mom and dad to get in the car to go to church, and the family across the street was also coming out, and they were throwing snowballs, and they were strapping the skis on the top of the car, and they're getting ready to go to the slopes while these kids are getting ready to go to church. And they said, Dad, you know, you know, why can't we be like them? You know, why can't we go do what they're doing? And the dad just responds and says, yeah, but they're not really happy.
Well, he can't afford to believe they're happy, can he? It would challenge his whole paradigm.
Yeah.
And that's
well,
what he's training his
exactly
children.
Right. You know, it's the mores, it's how we're raised, it's, you know, we're going to grow up in fear and realize that we are inferior. Now, one of the things that you say in your article when we're talking about the evolution of the human being,
mm-hmm.
and eventually, at least as far as I know, I don't know too many immortals, most people die. And after they die, this dreamwalker can accompany them, or at least their consciousness can accompany them through some unfamiliar territory. But one of the amazing things about the dead, you say, is our friends and relatives do not always look as they did when they died, but often the way they remembered themselves being, perhaps a favorite
at the happiest time in their life. Yes.
Right. You know,
This makes it a challenge for the dreamwalker to make sure you've got the right client. Because you might have a picture of the person who died, but the person you meet doesn't look the same. But you can tell from the energy anyway, and from asking questions.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that the human individual evolves in a single lifetime based on the energy environment that person creates for themselves by what they
exactly
eat, how they exercise, where they live, how they handle stress. All of these things allow, or should I say facilitate, the genes of the body to make a wide choice of proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And so the person actually evolves into the being that they really mean to be. So if you meet someone that's a real sourpuss, and I can't tell you how many people, I've just casually caught them, you know, in a moment of respite or repose, and they look terrible. Their mouths are turned down and their eyes are drooping, and they don't realize what they've done to themselves. They're sitting there emitting an energy that woe is me kind of energy. And what they're doing is they're creating an environment in which their genetics are actually evolving to fit that very energy picture of themselves.
True.
So when you say, you know, this evolution is directed by us, we can do it.
Yes.
And after we die, we just speed up the process and become who we really want to be.
No. We don't become who we really want to be. We become who we really are. Now, if you're talking the mid-stage, yes, they will appear different. They will sometimes appear as a younger version of themselves.
Well, therein lies the problem. That you don't become what you really want to be, you become who you really are. Why in the world would someone be or are something they don't want to be?
Because they bought into the program. Look, you watch the television, you watch the movies. We have all bought into the program that when you hit a certain age, you're old. Or if you do a certain thing like smoke or drink or whatever, you're going to get lung cancer, or you're going to get cirrhosis of the liver, or you're going to get... We've bought into the program. We believe that externals can control us, and therefore we manifest that. It's a lie. But as long as you believe the program, it is the truth for you. We have so much more power over these bodies than we realize. It's not the easiest thing in the world to learn how to use that power, because we're being inundated all the time from the 3D world. And if you do have a miraculous healing, as I did, and then you tell people about it, they will do their darndest to talk you out of it and to get you sick again, because you're challenging their belief system.
Yeah, I know.
Or they'll make all kinds of excuses. Oh, the lab must have made a mistake, or this or that. Okay, fine.
You should
not going to argue
that at your age.
Hmm?
I said you shouldn't be doing that at your age.
Whatever they say. It's a case of the crabs pulling the one crab that's escaping out of the bucket. The other crabs will reach up and pull them back in. Don't you dare step out of this pail. You belong here with us suffering. And sometimes, and that has caused a lot of us to just stay under the radar, just stay quiet, you know, one-on-one, don't get too big, don't get too cocky, because if you get too big, the powers that be will have to slap you down. That was our belief then. Now people are saying, screw it, I'm going to be who I am. If somebody doesn't like it, they can deal with that. But I'm not pretending anymore. And that's actually why I'm talking to you tonight, because it's not something I've advertised or, you know, promoted in any way. It's just, it is who I am. And you express interest, and I will willingly share with you whatever I can.
Well, that's what this program's all about, is about exploring the mysteries of the universe and the earth.
And there are so many.
Oh, yeah.
It's an exciting time to be alive.
Oh, it is. And I love those words. That's the right kind of words for this program. Exactly right. So a dreamwalker, I guess if the man on the street were to think about this, they would say, well, then the dreamwalker actually walks with ghosts. So someone asked me the other day, why don't ghosts hang out for centuries? They just kind of haunt for a short time, and then they realize that they're dead, and then they move on. Is it because a dreamwalker, you know, catches up with them and says, okay, it's time to go?
Sometimes. Sometimes they don't realize they're dead. Like I say, after you die, you create the reality that you expect. If your death was sudden, or if you really didn't want to die at that point and you had unfinished business, often you'll stay in the near realms and you'll recreate a reality that's exactly like the one you left, and you will just tell yourself, I'm not dead. Everything's still the same. I'm still here. And you will live in that reality, and sometimes it bleeds through into our reality, and those who are sensitive can feel or see the residual energy. And if you want to, you can get a dreamwalker to go in, and or the other people, the people who do exorcisms and whatever, those are usually more for what they call violent spirits or poltergeists, but you can get someone to go in and talk with the spirit, explain to them that they're dead, explain to them you need to walk through, and Ghost Whisperer's not a bad show from some aspects, but she points them to the light. She says, you know, you're done here, you need to go to the light. And they will, when they are finished what they felt was unfinished, they will then go to the light. Now, you see, she's like a dreamwalker because she can't, well, sort of, she can't see the light. I can see the light.
Right. Well,
and I do go with them. And then I will see them drop the human body. When I first meet them, they're still a human-looking being. But as they progress through to the clarity and understanding of why they lived that life, what they went in to accomplish, what they accomplished, what they didn't quite get to, and so on, then they will drop the human body. And it was the first time it happened, and I saw it happen, was just miraculous, because here's this person standing there, and this is a person I'd known, and I see him standing, and all of a sudden it's just like the flesh, I don't know, melted or sunk into, or this light came out of him, and it just all of a sudden it there was this light being standing there, still human-shaped, but not looking as he had, and the glow was so bright I almost couldn't look at it. And the feeling of love coming from this being, because he had now connected with the one. He knew who he was. He knew why he had chosen that lifetime. He knew why I was there. He honored my assisting him. And it was just like a feedback loop of love. It was like a nonstop orgasm almost. It was a wonderful, wonderful feeling that I wish everybody could feel. Because if you knew in your gut that this is what's going to happen to me after I drop this body, which is really like taking off a suit of clothes, you wouldn't be so afraid to go there. I'm not saying you'd rush to it because you want to enjoy this reality for everything it's got. There are so many experiences and so many wonderful sights and smells and tastes and everything else. But when it's time, when you're ready to drop the body and go on to the next experience, you can do it joyfully. You can say, okay, yeah, you're still going to be sorry to leave your family. Of course, you don't just stop feeling for the people that you love in your life. But you understand that you're not really leaving them. You'll still be around.
Well, a lot of people are wondering, you know, they wonder, where am I going to go? Is it unknown? And am I going to come back? You know, I'm not finished. There are things I wanted to learn, things I wanted to do. I never got to learn to dance or to fly.
Yeah, but remember, those are desires of the ego.
No. I don't agree with that. I rarely say that on this program. But
okay.
You know, when we come to this world, it is an amazing place for experience, and the greatest souls in the universe have come here for a mortal experience because of its ability to both limit the soul and provide the soul an excellent area to have experience. To love and to experience, you know, pain and challenge and all of those things. And it really isn't about, you know, how many worlds can I conquer.
It is not about all.
You know, I want to experience these things. I want to know what it's like to skydive and ride a horse and paint a picture. And there's just not enough time in a single lifetime to do all of that.
Right.
And it is definitely not fair that a soul comes here, gets to live 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, 120 years, because that's a flash, cosmically speaking. And there's
but
just
it's also
not enough
your
time
choice.
To do everything.
It's also your choice when you leave.
So if a person chooses not to leave for 250 years, then they just don't leave.
Well, we don't have that much control over the body. We don't know how to do that. It's possible, certainly. I absolutely believe that it's possible. But we still, I mean, we're fighting all this programming. You grew up knowing that you were going to get old and die. I mean, you knew that as a kid, right? Most people?
Well, I don't know.
Now, if you grew up and you never knew that anybody died, maybe that, you wouldn't have to fight that program.
The way I always thought of it is you get old and you live again.
Oh, well, that's true. And when I say you don't get to do those things, yes, you can come back. It's not a case of this is your one shot and that's all there is, and if you don't get to do it now, you're out of luck.
Well,
of course
there you
not.
Go.
We come back lifetime after lifetime. You may come back to Earth. You may come back to, what is it, Vega. I just watched Contact this afternoon, a wonderful movie. You may go to another reality, another dimension where they don't have physical bodies, but they have different things.
Right.
It's your choice. You choose that because you decide, not you. The difficulty is when we say you, we all think of me, this identity that's in this body right now, my consciousness. What I mean is your higher self, your whole self, decides that it wants to experience something. It decided it wanted to come to Earth to experience certain things, and it has done that lifetime after lifetime. And it has experienced various things. It has experienced being murdered. It has experienced being in love. It has experienced all kinds of things, everything you can imagine. It has also had another agenda that it wanted to evolve. It wanted to learn, how can I be a spiritual being in a human body? How can I learn to believe that everyone on Earth is as high as I am, is as good as I am, is as perfect as I am? And that's a hard one for us, because we see people doing things that we judge. We look at the murderers and the rapists and we put them in jail because they're offensive to society. But we've all been murderers and rapists and their victims. In one lifetime or another, we have experienced this. And until we get to a point where we can say that basically there is no right or wrong, there is only experience. Now, for a human to say that, it really raises some hackles. Because we want to judge. We don't want to acknowledge those dark impulses in ourselves. And yet, under certain circumstances, we are all capable of the most atrocious crimes.
Well,
now, for you, it might take more than it would take for me to you know, display a certain behavior. But basically, we're all capable of those. But we make different choices.
Sure.
And as you evolve, you make better, for lack of a better word.
We are our own judges. You know, no one can judge us. By our own energy signature, we are judged. I did want to remind you, listeners, that the phone lines are open, 888-228-4494, anywhere in the U.S., toll-free. Canada, it's 877-489-6350.
We have a problem. I do.
And anywhere else on planet or off planet, 530-776-5154. And I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from. Caller, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, your first name and where you're calling from?
This is Ann. I'm calling from Northern California.
Hi, Ann. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch.
Do you have a question for Sally?
I beg your pardon?
Do you have a question for Sally? You might want to turn your...
No, I just want... Well, I do in a way, yes. This is Anne. Of course, I agree with everything you're saying. I wonder if you agree with me that we agreed to come to this lifetime this time, and it probably will be the last one that we will have in this kind of condition. Do you believe that?
In this kind of condition?
Yes.
I agree with that.
You do? Yes.
There are many who think this is our last lifetime. I don't know.
No, I don't feel it's the last lifetime, but I think it's the last lifetime on this planet in the condition it's in, because it's going to go into the fifth dimension, I think.
Well, you're talking about the new Earth?
Yes.
Yes. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I think we are evolving, and it's happening so quickly now. I mean, when I started this journey, it was so rare to even be able to talk to anybody about anything.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But now it's just snowballing, and it's wonderful. It's a very exciting time.
It sure is. I'm going in my 86th year here.
Wonderful.
And very, very excited. And Brooks knows who I am, a little bit anyway. But I've enjoyed what you've been saying, and I agree with you, yeah.
Well,
and I really do love these children that are coming, and the crystal children, and apparently the next batch will be the rainbow children. But these crystal children are so right there. I think they're just vehicles for masters to come and be with us and help us this time.
Yep. Well, they're absolutely knocking 3D on its pins,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah.
They're really challenging society. Yeah.
It's,
and that's what they're trying to do.
Interesting. It'll be kind of interesting to see the mega marketing program and have the crystal children and the indigo children and the rainbow children not coming to the sale.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they can see through. They can
see through
everything.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Especially these crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the crystal children. Can you hear me or not? You're kind of faint.
Who I am?
Yeah, I can't hear you very well.
Oh, sorry.
That's better.
Okay.
I've been having fun talking to the parents of these crystal children and saying to them, "Do you know who you have?" And they usually say no. And so I said, "Well, you know, you have someone that chose you to be with them because and you want to listen to them because they will teach you."
Yes. And that's a hard thing for parents to accept.
Well,
they taught.
Yeah, very often they're indigo kids themselves, and they light up when I talk to them like that. They really like it. Well, I'm going to go because I don't want to keep you on. I'm enjoying
it. Oh, but thank you for calling in. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you,
Brooks, tell him I finally got through today. Been trying for 3 or 4 weeks. Okay, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in. Thank you for listening, too.
86 years young.
Yeah, exactly. And when you meet her, you say exactly the same thing. She's just like a kid, you know, bouncing through the mountains. She goes to all these expos and conferences and seminars, and she's just really a bright light. And there are a lot of women out there like that. I'm thinking of Sister Harvey, who's just an amazing English woman, and I've seen her several times out there on the road, and she's just a really bright woman, and her son is just amazing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of leads me to the next question. You know, we've been talking about these individuals coming here at this time, And I think maybe the concentration of them is such that they're not just onesies, twosies. They're almost like whole planets, small planets worth of special, very highly skilled, very highly sensitive beings coming to this world. And they're going to be able to lead us through this dimensional confusion that we are about to embark upon.
You're right. You're right. And they do tend to come together because they need each other's support in 3D. So you will find there will be several born in a small neighborhood and a bunch born in a country where they are able to interact. And one thing someone was commenting on the board that I'm on, these kids often communicate by touch. And you'll quite often see them with their foreheads together. And neither one is saying a word. But they are, in fact, communicating. And they're used to this. It looks weird to other people who don't even know what they're doing. But these kids are so open. They have so many abilities. And I think maybe they don't want to show them to us, the old folks, because, well, they don't want to freak us out, for one thing. For another, they don't really know that we can understand it. And so it's really good for them to have adults around them who are open to it, even if they don't believe, if they are non-judgmental, and they will allow these kids to do what they do. The adults will learn. They can't help it. They will learn.
Well, it's kind
of interesting. And that's the joy of having them here.
Up here in eastern Washington State, and we're up here by the Idaho and Canadian borders in a small town that's actually below the surface.
Below the surface.
Yeah, sort of. It's in a river valley, and so from just driving along, you don't see it until you come down into this kind of river valley. But it's basically desert area, and it would be unless they drilled down deep to find water to irrigate the wheat. But one thing it does give you is it gives you a big sky up here. And at night, there's not much light pollution, so you can see stars and galaxies that you cannot see in other parts of the country because of trees and mountains and lights and things like that. And one of the questions that you can't help but have when you're out here in the expanse during the day and the sky is blue and cold, or at night when there's so many stars you couldn't possibly count them in a lifetime, and you say, you know, if there are craft from other worlds up there, why can't I see them? I've got a great view from here. And it is this, a feeling of blindness, a feeling of helplessness, because you know they're there. And
well,
they
now,
probably know you're here.
Sure
but
they do.
Can see you and you can't see them.
Well, that's interesting, because there's a saying, you'll see it when you believe it. Okay. Sorry, it's you'll believe it when you see it. That's what people used to say. Well, now it's you'll see it when you believe it.
That's right. You'll see it when you believe it.
Yeah.
Well, we have another caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hello, this is Dale from upstate New York.
Hi,
Dale. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's the first time I've been able to get through.
Wonderful. Glad to have
no
you
accident.
On.
No accident.
Yeah, I guess not. I have a question for both of you.
Sure.
Now, you guys talk a lot about having the choice to do many things. But my observations of how things are working, especially in the United States, is that there are a relatively small group of people with a lot of power that are really trying to grind us down to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
How can we still have choice when we have such an obstacle like that to overcome?
You have a choice for your experience.
Yeah, your choices are outside their system. You know, they have power as they perceive it. But if you've ever been to Washington, you have to be convinced we don't really have a government. I mean, we have a loose coalition of bureaucracies, but we don't really have a single government.
Right.
I said the government is really not aware of us, and they know that we self-destruct. ourselves. All they really have to do is just stay out of our way, and we'll take care of ourselves, which we routinely do. We fail quite well on our own without them.
And I agree with that, but they have a tendency to stick their nose into everybody's business, especially when it comes to finance.
Right.
Well, that's true.
But you're strictly talking 3D.
Right.
Well, I see where he's coming from, though. Once a year, you have to sit down and divulge your financial standings to the government, who will then review it and decide how much money you owe them. So I see where he's coming from.
Right. And, you know, I've done some research of my own, and I've come to understand that just about everything the powers that be have told us, especially for the last 100 years, is a bunch of bull. And I'm actually what you might consider a Joe Sixpack type, except I'm no longer interested in basketball, football, racing, or guzzling down beer.
Oh, good for you.
Good.
Good for you. I'm glad to hear there are a few men out there who aren't.
I'm just trying to figure out how to get my family through the changes that are coming. That's all I'm concerned about.
Well, I don't look at it as being catastrophic changes. I really don't think it's going to be that bad, but that's only my opinion. I know a lot of other people think it's going to be pretty awful. Knowing that you are never without and you're never alone can give you the freedom to make choices that are most effective for your life. And as more and more people take responsibility for themselves, they become more powerful. Not in a 3D sense of I can depose the president or whatever, but as there are more and more of us, politics eventually has to take notice because they will be getting too much flack from those of us who just refuse to accept that any longer. But they're doing a good job. And, I mean, God, I wouldn't have believed I would have said this about Mr. Bush before this, but he's actually doing an excellent job at showing us our darkest side. And by doing that...
Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, by doing that, though, he's making people take a stand. He's people who have been apathetic all their lives, not interested in politics. As long as I've got my beer and my football and my whatever, I don't care about anything else. Even these people are becoming enraged, and they're saying, okay, it's time I got involved. It's time I looked at this, and it's time I made some choices. Nothing else, no other president has gotten people as involved. Granted, it's against him, but they are at least functioning and getting involved in life, and they're choosing life. That's a major step.
I have one other question, and I'll get off the line.
No, that's okay. Lately, ask your question, because I want to ask you a question, too, so don't go away. Ask your question.
Okay. Especially since around the year 2000, I have experienced personally this every so often this upwelling of emotion, you know, and I try to contain it around a lot of people because, you know, it's just not something to do in our society. But it keeps coming back. You have any idea what that's all about?
Sure. You're growing up. You're ascending. You are also experiencing it now. It could be your own emotion that you've kept buried for so long because it's not acceptable to our society for men to cry or whatever. Or you could be picking up on the emotion around you. As we evolve, we are becoming more aware of the emotions around us. And then the difficulty is to recognize, is this mine, meaning it's my emotion generated by my experiences, or is this nothing really to do with me except I'm sensitive to it? I'm picking up on someone else, which is actually what happened to me and how I got into the whole thing.
I keep thinking that I'm picking up something from somewhere else, not just my own.
If that thought comes to you, then that's what it is.
I can tell you both, just from my experience and from what I've learned on this program, that there is something non-local going on right now, a connection between maybe it's the past and the future, maybe it's other parts of our universe or even other dimensions, but they are tapping into us because we've been tapping into them with our emotion and our what we do here on this planet affects other places in the universe.
Of course.
And often, they affect us back. And those mm-hmm. that are sensitive to it have these emotional connections. And once
yep.
you recognize that, it's actually kind of a joy rather than a fear.
Yes. If you can just accept the feeling and allow it to flow and not try to, you don't want to try and say, oh, why am I crying? Oh, it's because this. Just know, okay, I'm feeling very sad right now. Let it flow. Go to a private spot. Let it flow. And then it's gone.
That's what I do.
That's perfect.
And I let it pass and I go on.
Yeah.
Now, Dale, do you live in a big city or do you live in the small towns in upstate New York?
Actually, I live in a small resort town on the St. Lawrence River. I'm in upstate New York.
Wow. Sounds beautiful.
That's nice.
It is. Pretty area. But my profession involves me working at a military base. And just about every time you drive through the gate, it's a pretty negative feeling you get.
Is that when the emotion hits you or does it hit any time?
No. I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, I was watching a movie called The Last Mimsy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, that's an amazing movie. That's an amazing movie.
Yes, it is. And when I watch that movie, that's like a trigger. That's one situation.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Tibet a week after seeing that movie. And it was so incredible how all that tied together. It was amazing. That is
mm-hmm.
a real sleeper of a movie. If you haven't seen it, you need to get out there and watch it.
I agree.
I own it.
I agree.
I bought it.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, there are some movies that are worth owning. Not most of them, I have to say, but some of them.
As we're
evolving, Dale, we are becoming feeling beings. Now, we've been conned into thinking in the past that intellect was everything. That your education was all that counted. And we stuffed our feelings down so deep so that we could be these successful, cold business people or whatever, it backfired. Because now the feelings are coming up big time, and not only our own, but as you felt, we're feeling other people. And I'm the same as you. I watch a movie, and I'll sit there and sob. And there's nothing in my life causing that. But we can identify with each other. Now, think how wonderful it will be when it gets to the point that these terrorists can feel the emotion of their victims and that we can feel the emotion of the terrorists so that we can begin to understand where are they coming from? Why do they feel they have to do this? And can we find a meeting of the minds and a meeting of the hearts so that we don't need to go to the physical war effort? Can we find a solution to this? My hope is that we can, that we're evolving and it'll happen fast enough that we can stop playing these games. And I think that is
the thing is
humanity.
I'm not a well-educated person, but I see in many people so much potential to achieve so much, and I see them waste it. I see people that, you know, they have this incredible amount of resources behind them, yet they do nothing but make everybody's life miserable. And I can no longer understand why that's happening. It makes no sense.
Right, it doesn't to the intellect, but if you could put yourself into their shoes, if you could feel who they really are behind that, you'd probably find there's a very scared, shy human being back there who's scared to death to stand up and say, hey, notice me, I'm important, I've got some talents and skills I want to offer, because they've been knocked down enough times. And that will change your perspective of them, which will then change their perspective of themselves, because we're all mirroring each other.
Well,
I
kind of feel like Dale.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to get off now.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Pleasure to speak to you both.
All right. Thanks, Dale.
Bye.
So you were going to say you disagree there?
That people would be a mirror of the emotion and a mirror of the manifestation. But and for the most part, they are. You know, you could be mm-hmm. sent into an area that's just dark and fearful. But you can make your own space. And you can push back the darkness. Because if you're a child of the light, then that's your job. Light the torch.
Yes.
Drive the shadows back.
Yes, but it's not to judge the shadows. The sh- shadows have a right to exist. They just don't have to exist in your space.
Well, I intend to expand the light and darkness.
So there is no darkness?
Dark somewhere else.
Oh, okay, somewhere else, okay.
Yeah, it could just be dark somewhere else.
Okay.
So, so do you think that these people who have passed through, do you think, are they full of fear? Are they full of wonder? I mean, is it dangerous to travel by yourself on the other side?
Apparently it can be. I personally have never had a problem, but there is a course that you can take to learn how to do it, because if an unskilled individual tries to do it, it's not that it's impossible. It's just that you can get detoured and you can get sidetracked and you can get stuck there yourself. If you don't have the training and the understanding of who you are, of why you're there, and of what you can and cannot do. And there are spirits there who are of a lower vibration because they haven't allowed themselves to go further, who will try to distract you and try to draw you in to their fantasy or to their reality. And if you make the mistake of engaging them, then you can get sucked in and forget who you are.
Well, is there some kind of big enemy out there gobbling up souls and getting them lost and confused?
No. No,
okay,
I have never encountered.
That's what I wanted to know.
No.
And then there's hope.
There's nothing out there but love. And love always says yes. If you want to believe you're persecuted, okay. I don't know why, but I'll give it to you. If you want to believe you're loved and you're unique and you're special, great, okay, I'll give it to you. The answer is always yes. But you pose the question.
I understand. There's a lot out there that to learn, and there's more to it than meets the eye, and I think you're probably right. Believing is seeing.
Yes. Yes. And well, there's so much we're seeing now.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the program.
I appreciate you having
notice.
Me.
And
I thoroughly enjoyed. Thank you.
It has brought light and knowledge to this program, and I appreciate your coming on. I never knew what a dreamwalker was, and now we know. And maybe we'll have you on again when I have more questions about it. I may do some more reading about it and have you back on.
Well, feel free. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for allowing me to share. And if anybody there has heard what I've said and at least given a second thought to, gee, maybe it's not as hopeless as I thought, then I've done a good job.
Do you have a website to take people to if they want to learn more about it?
I don't at the moment. I took my website down because I was distracted by other things, but I am building a new one, and as soon as it's up, I'll send you the information, and maybe you can put it on your website as a listing beside me, or beside the broadcast.
We'd be happy to. All right. I'll let you get back to your evening, and we'll carry on with our next hour. Thank you so much, Sally.
Houston, we have a problem.
State your problem.
Picking up transmission from Mars.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Your host, Brooks Agnew, believes everything we do will eventually affect the universe. He's trying to do that on purpose each Sunday from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the BBS Radio Network. Come where the results are always positive. Explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You'll be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch. X Squared Radio.
Hi, this is Brentwood from Legion of Love. Just letting you know you can now hear some of our new released and unreleased tracks on our website, legionoflove.com. You can also purchase our EPs, Gray Matter Tunes and Matters of the Heart, as well as all of our singles, including Shine a Light and Love is the Answer, at most major download sites. And of course, you can hear them on BBS Radio, the number one internet radio network in the world. Peace and love.
Hi, everybody out there.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. We have a little bit different format tonight because we have multiple guests. We usually just have one, but there was so much activity recently that we had to get Standeo on because of those 600 earthquakes in 10 days off the coast of Oregon, and we wanted some clarity on that. And then we had Sally come along with her information about dreamwalkers, and we just finished that as we ended the second hour. And this is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure that you give us the name of your affiliate at x2-radio.com, and we'll do the rest. We'll make sure that we get that all 3 hours out there to you. We do have a caller that's been hanging on the line since the last hour and has a question, and we want to bring you on. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Yeah, this is Bernoulli. From DB, Virginia Beach.
Hi. And you had a question about what we were talking about in the last hour, the dreamwalkers.
Yes. I like the way she was talking about how it's all your own mindset, even after you die, where you're going to go or what's going to happen. And you want to come back because of all the different things that you want to experience, and that's what's really amazing. But there's a thing that I've read, and I've researched a lot of things ever since my brother died in Iraq, and then I'm telling you, things started to occur. I mean, it's like miraculous, like things that just don't usually exist in a 3D dimension. So it's like little like spurts, more or less. And there's this one book that I wrote that it's on the web. It's like the Lost Books of the Bible. And I'm wondering if you've ever even heard of that or even like read any of it. It's very interesting.
Yes, I have read Lost Books of the Bible. Great stuff.
And there's even, you know, the Secret Book of John, that's where I got the, you know, I mean, pronoia is the actual, in the Secret Book of John, it's the action after the thought, which is where we really came from, is more or less the beginning of everything became, first it was a thought, and then it became action. It's just like, I read the whole, it's like the Secret Book of John is really the real Genesis, instead of the one in the regular Bible, because a lot of the Bible is some of the truth, but some of it's really just not very, you know, truthful.
Well, it's been filtered, you know, and it's been kind of watered down to this point. And some of it's
right.
Because of the century in which it was written. Some things were accepted. For instance, the writings of Mary, although very important for our day, were not really accepted in her day because women weren't allowed to express themselves openly. It just wasn't socially acceptable. But John has it exactly right. Thoughts precede actions. The thoughts also have their own energy, and they create their own space depending on how much we dwell on them.
Right.
So when I was saying in the last hour that we actually judge ourselves, that's exactly how we do it. We actually build our own being, whether we're a being of light or a being of darkness.
I think I made the statement just last night, and it was a very interesting statement I made to my girl. It's more or less how really what evolution is evolution is like, you know, progress into everything. In other words, we are already connected. We just don't know it yet. And we are everything.
Well, that's pretty close. We actually are everything. We are source.
Seems like we're just a separate entity within everything that's all interconnected and all love. I mean, really, that's what really we're... Existence really was all because of love. I've read that other places, and I've actually felt it, you know? I mean, there's no way that, you know, we're going to be... You know, yeah, there's negative and positive, but positive will always prevail because that's what we really want, and being we, being everything.
That's amazing. And, you know, if we could manifest that with enough intention behind it, that maybe the fear that's perpetuating the world governments that we have and the current situation. We almost have another Cold War coming about. Maybe all that will go away.
Well, I've seen the movie Celestine Prophecy, and Celestine Prophecy is what's going to... If you feel in your mindset of all the negative things that's around you, then you're going to be stuck in that, you know, that 3D realm. But if you want to get into the 4D, 5D, and you know it, and you don't... I mean, you can even know the stuff that actually is negative, but if you don't let it get to you, or if you don't actually, like, even think about it, then you'll just be switching over to a whole different plane of existence, which is more or less heaven on earth. I mean, that's exactly what I'm thinking is going to happen within the next 10-something years, you know, after 2012 and all this new stuff that we're on, the Mayan calendar. I mean, it's a whole bunch of stuff that's just going to happen no matter what. In other words, it's him, you know, because it's really what we want, you know?
I think that very thing, heaven is no further than your own front yard.
I think, like you said earlier, it's like this is the best and most exciting time to be alive. And why do you think every single soul out there and every human and also alien are actually watching us, and then we're actually experiencing it? And you know, it's more just like even aliens are evolving. You know, I mean, they're not perfect either. They have to evolve. They just have a higher technology and what, and their feeling is also higher. But they'd like to see the us human beings, being how we've been conditioned, are going to actually be unconditioned, and that's what love from God and everything else is, unconditional love. And you know, it's just, why can't us human beings have unconditional love? Because we haven't progressed to that point yet. Are we going to?
I think we can, and I think many of us do. And you know, hearing your excitement and your energy, I think we're going to make it.
Oh. I would never even say we're. I think we are. We're just going to, no matter what.
I agree with you, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate your call. You made my week.
Yes. Well, thanks a lot. Now I'll let you get on. And the next person you said is going to be who?
We have William Donovan on. We're going to talk about some new energy technology and how close it is to reality.
That's awesome. Okay, I mean, every Sunday I'm always, you know, looking up here, and I can't wait till you go to Hollow Earth.
I can't wait either. It's not suited enough for me, but it sure takes a lot of planning to get something that size done.
I mean, if I won the lottery, you'd get the money from me.
Okay, good. Put the
thanks
win
a lot, bro.
All lottery winners. Thank you so much for the call. All right, William, it's just you and me. Now we're talking about new energy technology. You know, there's a lot out there, but there isn't a lot out there. People think that there's no demand for it, but I can tell you otherwise. There's a huge demand for new energy technology. But we're going to talk for this hour about the disconnect, I guess, between the inventor and the showroom. So let's see if we can make some progress on it. What's out there, William? What are people working on?
Well, let's see. Arthur C. Clarke, who is the premier futurist, had an intense interest in the Casimir effect and producing energy out of the zero point using that. That's the most interesting one. And then there's several others, one of which is Paul Brown's device, which actually is a direct conversion system for radioactive energy into electrical energy.
Well,
then there's several others. There's something called a Dynaflux alternator, and Jim Murray is the one that did that one. It's documented to be over Unity. And then, of course, there are several others going back in time all the way to Nikola Tesla. And between that time and now, there's a lot of abandoned technology, is what I would call it.
Why would it be abandoned if we're in such need of clean, renewable energy and maybe able to tap into, well, what we might consider energy outside the box, which isn't really over Unity. It's just tapping into energy beyond maybe this dimension or this reality or the box. We just have to expand the box a little bit and then the math.
Right, right.
But, you know, why do things get abandoned? That's a good question. Why?
Well, one reason, in the case of the gasification technologies that Lewis Carrick had back in the 1930s, is that it was really uneconomical. I mean, it was actually more expensive to produce the gasoline and the coal oil at that time than it was to simply pump crude oil out of the ground to refine it. But now we're rediscovering that technology because it's actually cheaper to do that.
Well, the big picture is, you know, what is crude oil but just leftover, crushed, and heated over time algae? It's just oceans of algae that they're pumping out of the ground. So why not use the little beggars now and grow energy instead of digging it out of the ground?
Right, and one of the things in the low-temperature carbonization system that Carrick discovered is that it works with any biomass. I mean, you can actually turn garbage into fuel.
So it's a little like the old adage, you know, the bad news is the aliens are here, the good news is they eat garbage and make gasoline.
Yeah.
that technology's out there. You know, MPK
right.
Biogas, are, you know, they make methane out of cow manure in such quantities and are able to clean it and concentrate it to the point where they can run a generator and make electricity. And these agrarian communities in Europe are actually powering their cities off of their own waste, and they're pulling themselves off the grid one by one.
Right. Right. And another interesting point is that they're also really getting into tidal power, wind power. In fact, there's an array of windmills now in the North Sea.
Well, I like the wind power, especially when the wind blows all the time. They're not very efficient, but it just might be enough energy to, you know, to go over the edge. I know in Southern California around Palm Springs, there's literally thousands of acres of windmills because the wind blows through that pass all the time, and they power a good part of Palm Springs using wind, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And,
right, there are several other systems as well. Of course, we could go to the conventional side or the exotic side, and, I mean, there are good arguments for both, but I think the shotgun approach is best. Some people are really leaning toward the exotic side because it's the most interesting and the most attractive, but I think to diversify our resource base would be the best thing.
Well, yeah, and exactly. When you're talking about resources, historically, at least in this country, the big money for energy research came from the military.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, when the energy was discovered, it was, how can we use this as the latest, greatest weapon to have an advantage over our enemies?
Right, right.
I have to say, I really have to say, with all confidence, the last 10 years, that has really taken a shift. There is literally $1 billion, more than $1 billion out there, laying there, unclaimed, for new energy technology. We're processing 2 grants right now, and we just got done processing one last year. Which is why I'm up here in Eastern Washington State. The state of Washington put up $10 million in low-interest loans, and this project pulled in 43% of that money. So that's why this project is done, is because government wanted to support it. And it's a huge success. So there's money out there to do it. It's just a matter of getting the grant writers to sit down with you, or hiring your own grant writers, or sitting down through it and plowing through it yourself. But you and I think, are of one mind when it comes to realizing that inventors are great inventors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it.
Right, right. They're not really great strategists. They're very narrowly focused on their technology. And as far as a finance system goes, I mean, a lot of these inventors are, I mean, they're brilliant at what they do, but if you go outside of their field, they're lost.
Well, that's true, and I'm not saying that an inventor should be able to wear all hats, because
right,
you know, there are people that are really good at writing grants and really good at finding angel investors, and then there are people that are really good at building manufacturing facilities and making things, making tooling, making packaging, and setting up
right
customer bases and shipping, supply
right
chain management. What I'm talking about is pulling all that together in a multidisciplinary group that can make things happen.
Yes, you do have to have a holistic approach if you're going to make a success out of it, definitely.
Well, I mean, that's what General Motors does. You know, sure, they have 44,000 employees, and when we go to PPAP, which is Production Part Approval Process, when we go to these group meetings, yeah, we're meeting with the powertrain guys, and we're meeting with the body frame and stamping guys, and we're meeting with the exhaust team and the interior team. Why? Because we want to make sure what we're making doesn't interfere with what someone else is making. So if a bracket has to change,
right,
or a pipe configuration has to change, or a fuel management system has to be adjusted to match a catalyst, it can be done. And
right,
that's what the world of energy needs right now. And I think it's coming to be.
Right, right. There was a guy by the name of Jacques Fresco in Florida, and that's exactly his point, that we really need to have a multidisciplinary approach and integrate technology into society in a seamless fashion.
Well, how do we get... I mean, I know the general public is ready. It's just they can't go down to Home Depot and buy a generator that runs on gravity waves. We can't
right
go to AutoZone and buy a bolt-on accessory that gets us 90 miles per gallon. Why
mm-hmm
aren't these inventions hitting the shelf, William?
Hmm. I think it's a combination of different factors. The inventor is one. I mean, to be sure, I mean, there are some inventors out there that want to run the whole show, but they really haven't got the complete picture either. So it's really crippling them in a way. And then, of course, there are other factors as well. The inventor basically oscillates between having money and building and not having money and chasing after funding. In many cases, I mean, because of the economy, that funding dries up. So they change professions, and then their work becomes forgotten for a while. In fact, with many inventors, you hear the same thing, where I've been working in this for 20 to 25 years. And a lot of these inventors right now, I mean, they have workable, some of them do have workable devices, but it's taken them 25 years to get to where they are. And one of the things that I think needs to be done is some kind of an incubator, a technology incubator, where you can actually go to some of these inventors that have new ideas before they're 25 years down the road and bitter, and help them out and find out if this is a doable technology, and if so, then you accelerate the process.
Well, I like the incubator idea. I've been to a few in New York and also in Maryland. And I think I was in one and visited one up in Boston. It was more leaning toward the telecommunications technology, but there were a couple of hydraulic valve companies in there that were startups that had some ideas of making things generate less heat, less foam, and less resistance in hydraulics, and some
mm-hmm
ceramic technology. Incubators are out there, but I got to tell you, you know, the last, 18, 19 months, I've been through over 100 inventors, and, you know, they have a very similar situation in that they're constantly seeking investment money,
mm-hmm,
but when they get the investment money, almost to an inventor, we're seeing them show up with a new house or a new car, and we're trying to say, hey, you know, where's the widget that you were working on? Well, you know, it's been a long time, been working on this, and it's about time Daddy had a payday. And that makes the investors very nervous.
Right, right. Well, you know, the inventor does need to be compensated, but at the same time, and he does need to be part of the process, but giving an inventor that's been steeped in poverty for 20 years a big check is a really bad idea, I think, because, I mean, it's like taking the kid to the candy store. I mean, it takes a lot of restraint not to spend that money.
Well, you mentioned Nikola Tesla. You know, he was an amazing inventor, and he did catch the ear of, you know, Morgan and Edison, and they poured a lot of money into Tesla, and his technology made some of their technology possible. But Tesla was a guy that could go through huge amounts of capital, and he was a very public, very flamboyant person. And, you know, after the first major breakthrough in energy transfer, alternating current was invented and shown to be valuable. And then Tesla came back and said, no, AC is bad for biology. You need to go back to DC. They weren't ready to hear it. So they kind of put Tesla on the shelf, and we didn't hear from him again for about 10 years. And then finally got in bad health and passed away. But, you know, he died up in the, 1940s, and he was still a major player. His technology is still keeping engineers fascinated.
Right.
He ran out of capital and died, you know, virtually penniless.
In fact, there was one quote from Tesla when they asked him why he gave away so much of his money, and he said, well, it would only get in the way. And that is the mindset of some of these inventors, where they think that if they were putting their attention toward the capital side, that it would somehow taint them or it would affect the purity of what they're doing.
Well, maybe. I haven't met too many like that. They've been largely, you know, just living from paycheck to paycheck, trying to save up to buy one more length of gold wire to put into their invention. And, you know, I firmly believe that the next great technology is not going to come from the universities, and certainly not going to come from the Fortune 500 companies. It's going to come from someone's garage or their attic or their basement. It's going to come from someone's shop. Because these are the guys that already put in 30 or 35 years in an engineering firm, and they retired. And then they had this great idea of a better way to do it, and they're trying to bring it to fruition. I guess what I'm saying is there's no lack of great ideas, and there's no lack of capital. And there's certainly no lack of manufacturing space. My gosh, there's a million square feet of empty manufacturing plants in any city you want to go to in this country.
Sure.
But there is a disconnect between the three.
Definitely.
So we have to find a way to put them all together. We have to find a
way
to introduce one to the other and bring a relationship of trust and get that inventor out on the factory floor and watch his invention become available to the general public.
And many of them want to do that. It's just that some of them also, well, the control freaks, and I know both of us probably have encountered those, they basically want to be in control of the entire process without giving up one iota of that control.
Yeah.
And that's difficult. I mean, they really have to learn how to cooperate.
Well, and let them do what they do best. You know, let's give you a lab and the money that it takes to operate that lab and technicians to help you with that lab and let you do what you do best, which is invent, and let the manufacturers do what they do best, which is build stuff, and let the finance people do what they do best. And that's make money off of it. And then hopefully that money supports the whole process.
Right, right.
You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, the general public, they're not ready for an electric car. No one will buy it. I find that to be utter nonsense. The problem has been that only one or two companies has actually built an electric car that anyone would drive. I'm familiar with an electric car company that got started in Mexico because they couldn't get started in this country. And they made a fantastic truck. And it was made out of plastic, actually, an injection molded frame. And just by luck, just by luck, the inventor got his car into a national crash test because one of the car makers backed out and they had to make some frame changes, and this guy slid his car into the test, and the darn thing passed with every mark that you could imagine, and it didn't crumple. It bounced.
You could, wow.
It took a T-bone impact, and the technicians rolled it back on its tires and drove it away undamaged.
Wow.
And it was an electric car. And the neat thing about it is the batteries were nice and flat, laid below the center of gravity. This truck cornered like a race car. It
mm-hmm.
would accelerate 0 to 60 in 8 seconds, which is plenty fast enough. And it got over 300 miles on a charge. Now, what an amazing vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the inventor did so well with it that they used to buy Fords off the showroom floor, disconnect, take the engine out, and take the engine out, put their electric motor in, and just change the wiring after the battery. They left all the wiring to the car exactly the same, and the car was exactly the same as it came off the showroom floor, brand new, and people were buying them as fast as he could build them. And he got a letter from Ford Motor Company, a cease and desist letter. And so this inventor took the letter to Orrin Hatch and said, I got a letter from Ford Motor Company telling me to cease and desist, turning their cars into electric cars. And Orrin Hatch called up the head of Ford Motor Company and said, by the way, you know that appropriations you guys were wanting to get passed? I have a letter here on my desk I would like to see go away. And it did. And he was allowed to keep making that electric car. But
great.
Very soon, public demand for the car dried up. He just couldn't make the cars because no one was buying them. Now, that's amazing, but true. This is a production car with air
mm-hmm.
conditioning and wipers and seatbelts and all the bells and whistles you get on a brand new car, except it had an electric motor and a battery system in it. And you still had the trunk and you still had the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't sell. Why? I don't get it. And it didn't cost any more than the production car. They were actually selling the motors back to Ford.
Now, what was his primary market? Was that in this country or in,
it was in
the U.S.
country.
And Mexico? Or is
the drivers were in California, and that car was made in the 80s, and every single car is still running. Still on the road.
That's one good thing about electric vehicles is that they have a long lifespan. I mean, all you really have to do is just change out the battery rack periodically, and that's about it.
And the battery technology has come a long, long way since the 80s.
Right, right. In fact, now we have some ultracapacitors which may eventually actually replace the batteries, and they'll have a very fast charge time.
I've heard of those. They're a little like flash drives are to computing, just a whole bunch of storage and a little bit of space, and they charge up instantly.
Right, right. It's basically a large capacity storage system, which uses barium titanate for a dielectric. And they are engineered to the point where you can actually have a capacitor of several farads that you can hold in your hand.
Now, for those listeners that don't know what a farad is a measurement of energy that they use to rate capacitors. And a farad is a lot of energy, a lot of energy. We usually measure capacitors in microfarads or millifarads, but not farads. That is really amazing. Tell me more about that.
Okay. It's a proprietary technology that Maxwell Technologies is putting out, and it's still in the process of evolution in that I think we're going to see even greater capacities. These are rather low-voltage devices right now, and the drawback is that when you increase the voltage, you actually decrease the capacitance inside the unit, but that basically is an engineering difficulty that may be overcome in the future. Right now, the equation as far as the amount of power that you can store in a capacitor is CE squared, where it's the capacitance this case farads, multiplied by the voltage squared. And if you take a look at how many farads you might possibly put into an electric vehicle, let's say you have, 100 farads or so, and you also have, say, the whole system running at 100 volts, well, that would be 10,000 multiplied by 100, which would be something on the order of 1 million watts maximum.
1 megawatt, so, which is certainly enough to drive a car.
Yes, definitely.
Really only need about 120 kilowatts to drive a car, unless you're driving a Hummer, but a compact car could accelerate very quickly, operate the air conditioning, the power steering, the headlights, and the heater.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you'd have to have an electric heater because now you have no radiator to generate hot water for your cooling, for your heater core, so you have to generate heat using electric coils and resistive heaters, and that, of course, takes a lot of wattage, but 120 kilowatts would definitely run a car under most conditions.
Right. 125 kilowatts would give you an 8-hour range, so that would be, it would be a very good competitor to gasoline vehicles, and it would recharge rather quickly.
8 hours on a tank. No, maybe 4 hours
right.
on a tank, but not eight. And
you know, another thing is that if you had an air-cooled motor, you could probably vent the cooling air into the passenger compartment as well. However, because of the ionization effects inside of a motor, you would have some ozone production, which might be objectionable.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that. And besides those ions can put you right to sleep when you're driving. If you've ever noticed that when you drive fast, your car fills up with negative ions, which will make you drowsy. So you need to have a positive ion generator in your car to counteract those so that you can stay awake.
I thought it was the other way around, where you needed a negative ion generator, but okay.
Well, all I know is when I step out of my car, there's about a 4-inch lightning bolt that jumps from my elbow to my car door. So the car does build up a lot of electrons going through the air.
Yeah, well, okay. It's more than likely that it's actually pulling electrons off of the surface of the car and it's becoming positively ionized.
Okay, you got me. I can't tell which way the lightning bolt goes.
Yeah.
It's worse than rubbing your feet across the carpet and touching a door.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll make the muscles in your arm grip those keys.
Right, right.
I'm going to have to start dragging a chain behind my truck to get it to discharge. It's amazing. And you can hear it snap from 10 feet away. Anyway, the technology is out there, but
right.
You can't go down to your corner store and buy it. And the key, and honestly, I don't know if you feel the way I do, but I kind of get the feeling like we don't have a lot of time to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the window of opportunity is open now, and this is the time to actually make a move on a lot of this.
Well, William, where do you suggest that inventors who are out there who might be listening to this program live or might play it later as an archive, where do you suggest they go to try to get all these resources together? I mean, we have our resources, but I want to know your resources. What would you tell them?
Well, at this point, I really just correspond with inventors, and if they have a specific problem with their technology, I try to work it through for them, but I really haven't got a source as far as a monetary source for them. And I do have to mention that I have noticed a lot of sources coming and going, and in many cases, the funding basically collapses right before the inventor actually has his device completely completely built. That's another problem as well, that
you're saying that right before it becomes a prototype, the funding runs out.
Yes, yes, that's a problem as well.
Well, unfortunately, that's kind of the American way. You know, we save up our dollars and buy the next, continuum transfunctioner, and we take it home and hammer it out and make it fit. And that's how inventions happen in this country. If we had a daddy out there who could just shell out billions of dollars for people to do research, we wouldn't be in this fix, would we? But R&D,
no.
For now, it's sort of a kitchen effect. You know, you kind of have to do it in your own kitchen. But I can tell you, if you get a working prototype, something that works on the bench, and it's got a frame and wheels, and you can plug it in or fill it up or turn it on, there are places you can go that will take your prototype and turn it into a production vehicle. It's out there, I promise you. I'm not going to make a too big of a plug, but if you'll go to X Squared Radio, x2-radio.com, there are links to places for inventors that are at that stage. But if you're a pre-prototype, just keep plugging away at it, man. Go to your relatives, go to your friends, you know, borrow money when you can, save up money, take that income tax return, and go buy the next widget for your invention and take it to the next level. Nobody is going to invest in your technology like you will, not time or money. So just keep plugging away at it.
I think that's an important point. Also, I think that as much internal funding that the inventor can come up with, the better, really, because of two things. One is that he's going to, if he has to really put energy into making the money to do this, he's going to respect the process a lot more rather than being given a large check, in which case he's probably going to blow a great deal of it. If he has to make it on his own, then he's going to respect that. He's going to value that. So internal funding is very important with this.
Right. Well, let's categorize in the next 20 minutes. Let's categorize the types of energy devices out there we're talking about. Let's see. We have generators, right? These are things that just generate electricity that you can use for just about anything.
Right. And in that category, we have solid-state generators and we have mechanical generators. And then we also have chemical devices. We have devices, for example, the Stanmeyer hydrogen fuel cell. And we also have cold fusion devices. And that basically provides a low-grade heat below 1,000 degrees, which, incidentally, can be used to run a Stirling engine. And not many people out there have connected the two, but there's one inventor in particular that has, and I'm interested to see him pull that one off.
Now, what's the Stirling engine?
A Stirling engine, yes. A Stirling engine is a hot gas expansion engine originally built by Robert Stirling over 200 years ago. And it's gone through several different design stages. The beginning stage basically was using just air, just room pressure air. The second stage was, air at a compressed ratio of about 10 to 1, about 10 atmospheres. Philips of Eindhoven, and that's a Philips Corporation, had built some Stirling engines in Europe that actually used 100 atmospheres of compressed gas, typically helium, and showed that they could produce up to 3 horsepower per cubic inch, which is, you know, very impressive. These are external combustion engines that just require a source of heat. So any source of heat that you can put into it, then it'll produce motive power based on that.
Well, I know from our own industry of biodiesel, one of the byproducts is about 100 to 120 gallons an hour of glycerol. And I understand that there is grant money out there that's seeking glycerol to change it into hydrogen for fuel cells.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that technology is out there, but I have not seen any commercial applications of it.
Hmm. Oh, there again, I mean, it's basically depending on getting the inventors together to do that. In the case of the Stirling engine, I mean, the people that were interested in either solar technology, which also uses low-grade heat, or cold fusion technology, which, again, uses low-grade heat, really never made the connection. When that connection was finally made, they realized that they could actually make the technology a lot cheaper. For example, a Stirling engine spinning an alternator that uses a hot water conduction loop is much, much cheaper than using a photovoltaic array.
Where do you get the heat?
From the sun.
Oh, I see. So driving or powering this during nighttime is out of the
right, case. Right. I mean, what you do essentially is you run it into a heat exchanger for the Stirling engine. The other end of the Stirling engine on the cooling side has another heat conduction loop that will heat your water and the living space as well. So instead of just directly heating a living space with the energy collected from the sun, it's co-generated. You actually have a device in the middle of this thing producing electrical power.
Well, that's nice. It sounds like it'd be more efficient than just a photovoltaic cell.
Yes, it is. Yeah, with the photovoltaics, we're only looking at about a maximum efficiency of perhaps 15%. You know, with this overall system, it probably would have an efficiency approaching maybe 65 to 70%, which is far greater.
Well, that's about what the internal combustion engine is. If we could just find a way to come up with that last 35% of energy from another source besides gasoline, then...
Right.
Then you'd have it.
Right.
All right. What about these mechanical generators? These are ones that could deliver torque to some turning device.
Right. There are several devices out there that could be considered over Unity. One is the Dynaflux alternator of Jim Murray, which has been documented to produce 150 to 200% efficiency. And he built this one recently and demonstrated it to several investors. I don't know if any of the investors have taken him up on that, but Jim Murray is an electrical engineer that has been working on his design for a long time. This is the most promising device that I've seen as far as a mechanical device in a long time. I could see that if he... further boosted the efficiency of that, it would probably approach around 300% efficiency, which is three times the power out than power in. Where the power is coming from, it's not perpetual motion. It's basically energy from, again, a hidden source, whether you want to call it the magnetic field, the zero point, or whatever. It's documented that this thing is breaking unity. So and it's really a moot point how it's breaking unity. It's merely the fact that it is deserves attention.
Yeah, just because it's coming from outside the box, you know, people might say it's breaking unity.
Right, right.
It doesn't really make a difference if nobody's paying for it to put it in there. Then it's over unity for all intents and purposes.
Right.
So if he's been working on it for a long, long time, what's the holdup? Why aren't we getting into full production with it? Why aren't we seeing it in, assisting Hummers at getting 50 miles per gallon?
I think Jim could probably give you a longer explanation of this thing. But whether it's just lack of interest or several things. For example, you know, I was amazed that people didn't have enough interest in the electric vehicle. I mean, I would have bought one of those.
Oh, me too.
But,
I mean, I drive, you know, way less than 300 miles a week, and I would definitely drive an electric vehicle. And these things were, you know, cost-effective, and he sold every single car that he made. But, in order to keep people employed, making wiring harnesses and buying batteries and doing all the mechanical change-outs and packaging up the engines and shipping them back to Ford, wouldn't it have been nice if Ford would have just sold him cars with no engine in them?
Yes. In fact, they're called gliders. Those are vehicles without engines.
Well, another inventor that I know mastered pulse charge technology in a Porsche, took the car to Porsche, and it was a 911 air-cooled engine, and he took it to them, and he showed them the car and said, this car produces 60% more horsepower than your car does. And here are my performance curves. And the head of Porsche at that local engineering firm said, well, we've seen these curves before. You've simply turbocharged the vehicle. And he said, no, I didn't. And that kind of got the guy's interest. So he tossed him the keys and said, here, keep start with 3 weeks, whatever you need, do all the tests that you need, and get back with me.
Mm-hmm.
So about 3 weeks later, this Porsche engineer called him back, and he went back, and he said, okay, you know, we give. We see you got 60% more horsepower out of this car than we get out of our stock Porsche. And it was interesting. But what interested us the most is that you got 30% more gas mileage out of it. How did you do that? And that's when it hit him, that economy was what would sell and not power. And that's when
right.
he went into these ultra-high mileage vehicles. He competed in, let's see, this is 2008. He competed in 2004 against all the major car makers, Ford, GM, Chrysler, Toyota, Nissan, Honda, and he got 99 miles per gallon, and he beat the fastest car there by a tenth of a second, and no one in 4 years has touched that record. And he's been invited to race again this year. Unfortunately, he's so busy doing something else, he's not going to race this year. But his pulse charge technology is really amazing. He was getting more mileage than the Prius in 2004. And by the way, he was the owner of the first Prius in the United States. And he took it completely apart and figured out how it gets such high mileage. And I could reveal that on the air, but I won't. But suffice it to say that next year he's going to compete again, and this time he's shooting for 150 miles per gallon, and he'll make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I won't talk about that either, but I know the technology behind it. It is very simple in that any electrical engineering student can realize this after they take a look at the design.
Right. It's there for the grabbing. And
right.
I've been hired to reverse engineer some technology where the inventor is long since gone and his stuff ended up in a warehouse. It was kind of sent along, sold along, passed along, and finally went up for auction, and somebody I knew bought it and didn't know how it ran, so he hired me to come in and reverse engineer it, which I did. And it was kind of interesting because although the thing looked really neat, even the videos from where it was allegedly running, it was a sham. It wasn't an engine driving a generator. It was a generator driving an engine. So, you know, nice dog and pony show. Made the inventor a lot of money. But he didn't.
Yeah, I've seen a few of those, too. Yeah. And, you know, there have been some inventors out there that have worked on... Now, keep in mind that a lot of these inventors aren't invulnerable. I mean, they're not immortal either. And that if they're working on a device for 25 to 30 years, then in some cases, I mean, they expire before the design ever sees manufacturing.
Sure, right, exactly.
And
the ever-present, what is it? I don't know. There's some kind of conspiracy theory out there. We don't do them here on this program. You can hardly talk to an inventor without them telling you about somebody knocking on their door and telling them to stop doing what they're doing or they're going to do bad things to them. And I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I have a hard time with that.
Yeah. But, you know, I do know inventors that are in their 70s and 80s. I mean, personally, I know them. And, I mean, they're basically coming to grips with the point that, well, you know, I have a device and it's working, but I don't think I'll ever see this thing ever go into production. And there have been inventors out there that have passed away, and their inventions have gone to their children, their inheritors, and then they didn't know what to do with them. So, and that's happened.
Yeah. Yep, I had that exact same thing happen, and evidently the original inventor took a circuit board, a key part of it, to the grave with him. He didn't tell his kids where he put the circuit board, so his kids can't figure out how to make it work either.
Yeah, yeah, that happens. Yeah, and if you can get the notes from the inventor, so much the better, but then you have the estate to deal with, of course, but, I mean, if they're agreeable, then you might be able to get the technology to market.
Well, William, is there hope? I mean, do you think that an inventor is going to step forward with the next, replacement for the internal combustion engine or the heat pump or the refrigerator, something that, will turn the course, turn the corner on greenhouse gas emissions and make it happen?
I think so. In fact, I think that many of these inventions are already among us right now, and they're just waiting for development.
Well, I believe that, too. I think that they're out somebody's garage, workbench, and all they really need to do is make connection with a company who's formed with a higher function, shall we say. We're not going to make a gazillion dollars off this, but we're going to make 50 cents at a time, and we're going to make a million of them.
Mm-hmm. That's another thing is, a lot of the inventors really have a kind of a rather grandiose plan for their invention, but, I mean, if you think small, for example, one of the biggest polluters in this country is the internal combustion engine in lawnmowers. And if you can come up with an electric lawnmower.
Well, there is a company down in Florida that has mastered some very, very low friction bearings and very high RPM, super high efficiency, small engines.
Mm-hmm.
These are like 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 horsepower engines. And it would revolutionize the lawn care industry. If they would ever just release their technology and let people start using it in weed eaters and lawnmowers and things like that, I think the whole industry would change. My goodness, a Briggs, there's nothing more inefficient than a Briggs & Stratton four-stroke engine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can do other things with it. I mean, you could possibly run it off hydrogen, although you'd have to deal with the blow-by. I mean, the water vapor blow-by would go into the engine. And there are other things you could do with it, but, it really is an obsolete technology, and I think getting an electric lawnmower into the market is probably the next best thing. I mean, you're going to, for example, it's really difficult to have a robotic lawnmower that runs on gasoline for several different reasons, and control reasons especially.
Well, I don't know if you need a robotic lawnmower. I mean, electric lawnmowers have been around since the 60s. My grandfather owned one because he lived in a trailer park with a bunch of other grandfathers. And
right, but I'm talking about cutting the cable.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, but when you really think about it, electric lawnmowers, I mean, as far as just putting a battery rack on there, they run wide open anyway. So, I mean, you don't need to have a speed control on the thing, really.
No.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody's working one of those things out there, go for it, because we really need one.
Well, exactly right. And a lawnmower runs at, 2,500 RPM? I mean,
right.
A 2,500 RPM electric motor, the size of a Briggs & Stratton, would have, 50 times the torque of a gasoline engine.
Right. In fact, you can actually downsize the motor and still have plenty of power for an electric lawnmower like that.
Sure. Exactly. Well, we're out of time, William. I always enjoy talking about new energy devices, and we're going to talk again after off the air because I think you have some connections and I do too. And maybe
mm-hmm.
we'll try to get some of these inventors hooked up with a manufacturing facility and see if we can't get something out the back door.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think that would be an excellent idea.
All right. So I appreciate you coming on the program on short notice. And
Thank you. Thank you.
All All right. It's my pleasure. Thank you, and have a great rest of the week.
Well, thank you, Brooks, and looking forward for the next encounter.
It won't be too long, I promise. We're in the same
world. Okay.
It's a small world.
Yes.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye.
Good night. All right, my friends, that is it for X Squared Radio for April 13th. We'll be here on the 20th. Don't go away. I promise. Next week's show, you're going to love it. We'll be back. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.